Brace yourselves.
When you were young and your heart was an open book, you used to say, live and let live.
And then Axl Rose does Live and Let Die, like we're going to do today on Agents of Cool. That's why I told you to brace yourselves.
Wait, that was Axl Rose?
Yeah, no. Guns N' Roses did a cover of...
That was Paul McCartney and Wings. No, I had this horrible fear that Axl Rose was in Wings before he was in Guns N' Roses, and I just didn't know that.
That's an alternate universe I want no part of.
No,
Axl and GNR did a cover of Live and Let Die, frankly, probably ill-advised Axl Rose impression because it hurts the back of my throat. Okay. But I thought that was a good way to kick off. Welcome back to Agents of Cool. Today we are covering the first of the Roger Moore James Bond films, Live and Let Die. It's our plan, I think, to switch off between Roger and Patrick McGoohan in The Prisoner this year. We'll do a little Roger, we'll do a little Magoo, we'll do a little Roger, we'll do a little Magoo.
There may be a spy movie here and there we go see.
And there will be targets of opportunity as the year goes on. So my dirty little secret is that Roger Moore is my favorite James Bond. The internet, the world at large, would never have, I mean, even back in the 80s when I was growing up, you know, the cool kids like Sean Connery better. But I have always loved Roger the best.
How is that a dirty little secret? I mean, I've heard you say, Roger Moore is my favorite Bond.
I think this is the first time I'm saying it on the show.
Oh.
Like, okay. I'm putting this... I don't think I've said this on the show before. I'm putting this out in public.
We'd have to go back and look at our For Your Eyes Only.
I might have said it then. I don't see how I couldn't have. But yeah, I think I kind of want this on the record just for sure. Roger's my favorite. I like his movies. I think he's suave. I think he's debonair. I think he has style and humor. He gets away with smarmy double. They're not even double entendres. They're single entendres. He gets away with single entendres lesser men can't even conceive of.
It says in my bio, I enjoyed watching Roger Moore use gadgets and smooch people in the service of saving Western civilization.
Mech on the ladies.
When I was much younger, it was, you know, when you're 7, 8, 10, it's like, okay, we suffer the smooching, so we get back to the cool gadget. Okay, what does this wristwatch do this time? Okay, you know, you're much more about the, what are the cool gadgets and the spy stuff than the, okay, oh, all right, fine, whatever, these. Making doe eyes at this baby agent.
Actually, we're very different here because I was always into the babes too. It's like a lot of guys, I think, go through an era where, girls are icky. I never had that phase. There was never a part of my life. I think I am different from the run of dudes in this matter. I mean, like when you're 8, most guys are like, ooh, girls, yeah. I never had that. I've been into chicks as long as I can remember.
I mean, it wasn't icky ew. It was just like, okay, this is not as interesting as the cool doomsday plot.
Eventually we'll get past this part.
Yes, eventually we'll get on to the proper, you know, I guess maybe I would have made a good M. I don't know.
I remember being very into Melina in For Your Eyes Only. And I still kind of am, actually. My wife doesn't worry about this because all of my celebrity crushes are all like 40, 50 years ago. I love Daniela Bianchi in From Russia With Love, but even if she's still alive, she's not going to look like she did in 1963. So anyway, we're doing Live and Let Die today. We don't usually do a lot of news on this show.
And that's partly because by the time between the gap between recording this episode and me getting it edited and out to your ears, dear listeners, can be considerable.
Although today I think there's a couple of things we probably should address. As we record this, the great, great Albert Finney just passed away. Magnificent English actor. We addressed the matter today because he was Kincaid the Gameskeeper in Skyfall. And he was just a wonderful garrulous. He was a great warm teddy bear with a shotgun. That was a great movie, and he was great in it, as he was great in, so many other movies. People our generation, we're Generation X, we'll probably remember him as Daddy Warbucks. Our parents' generation would probably remember him as Tom Jones. God knows there's been all kinds of other movies over the years. So God rest you, Albert Finney, and thank you for your contribution to the canon of the material we cover here. What else? Live and Let Die is also the 8th James Bond film. Roger Moore's first. It struck me as interesting. This was the 8th, and there was some question at the time whether or not the series was going to endure a change of leading man. And they are, as we record this, in pre-production on the 25th James Bond film. So I think the question of whether or not the series would endure has been thoroughly well and truly answered.
Well, the question has been asked before in our lifetimes
It gets asked repeatedly.
Right, and partly because, I mean, look at the gap between the last one and, you know...
Between License to Kill and GoldenEye.
Or GoldenEye, yeah.
That was a 6-year, and then it's like, oh my God, it's the Cold War is over, the wall has fallen, is there room for James Bond? Well, yes, because Brosnan goes on and makes 4 James Bond films, each one making more money at the box office than the last. Then we have September 11th, and then it's like, well, shit, what role does James Bond have in this world?
Well,
and then Dan Craig comes out and does Casino Royale, and oh, well, we're back again, aren't we?
Well, and secretly, if you think about it, there are a number of film critics and pundits out there that would secretly be very, very, very sad if the James Bond movies stopped being made, yeah, because they could not recycle that same old, are we done with James Bond yet? Is James Bond really find a place in our world? It's like it's like superhero movies. At some point, if they stop making superhero movies, and there's going to be a whole bunch of critics that are going to actually have to find something new to bitch about rather than are we done with superheroes yet? Have we done everything we can do with superheroes?
No, actually, we're not. We're not done because we're not done with heroes. The film-going population, the people that actually sit down and watch movies because they're fun and entertaining and relaxing and interesting, are never going to be done with heroic characters. And that could be Bond, or that could be Batman, or that could be Spider-Man, or that could be whoever. And you're exactly right. There's always, every time, oh God, do we need another Batman movie? Oh my God, are they doing Spider-Man again? It's like, yes, they are doing it again because people like this stuff.
Well, apparently they all sound like Valley Girls, too.
Well,
God, I'm just so sick of this. I'm so sick of the Hulk. Oh, God.
The thing is, nobody ever asks, are we done with lawyer movies yet? Are we done with movies about doctors or police officers? Are we done with self-indulgent retrospectives about Hollywood and how awesome Hollywood is? Nobody ever asked that last question.
Nobody ever asked that question.
La La Land was the answer to that question. No, Hollywood is not done with that. It will never be done with that. Hollywood is basically in love with that little mirror over there.
It isn't always will be. And I don't know, maybe there comes the day where Barbara and Michael sell Ian and sell all the rights and some studio screws it up. 10 years down the line, 15 years down the line, 20 years
There'll
down the line.
There'll still be another one.
Yeah. James Bond will always return. Now, I'll say this. His name might not be Bond, but the guy who stands in the wall and goes out there and takes care of the bad guy and has some lovely gratuitous sex and violence along the way, this guy is always going to be out there.
Oh, I'm pretty certain it will be named. I mean, given...
But probably, yeah.
Given the remake,
James.
Well, we can do a new thing, or we can remake what was a sure thing. Well, let's remake the sure thing. How many remakes? And we're coming up with maybe remakes of remakes at this point?
And truthfully, I don't have a problem with that. I mean, you're always going to get new stage productions of Hamlet. There's always going to be another West Side Story. There's always going to be another Hamlet. There's always going to be another 12
and
Angry Men.
And that's literally another performance of the same thing.
The exact
that's
same
not
thing.
Not even another story about the same character.
Right. I don't mind a remake. What I mind is a lazy, bad remake. Where you
Total Recall. Excuse me. RoboCop. Excuse me. Oh, man. Something caught in my throat
there.
I'm
unclear on why even Kevin Smith is referring to his upcoming thing as the Jay and Silent Bob reboot, when I'm like, you are still literally the original Silent Bob. How can it be the reboot?
That's, well, because, oh, I've read about this. Here's what's happening. Remember Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back?
Mm-hmm.
Which actually the people at this table went and saw for my bachelor party.
Yep.
Which was an awesome time, by the way. They're making a movie of Blunt Man and Chronic in Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back.
Right.
And they're going out to Hollywood to get their movie check.
Mm-hmm.
Well, here we are, and in the world of the movie, they're rebooting Blunt Man and Chronic.
So they're going back out
to get their movie check from the reboot of the movie.
Okay, that works. I like it.
And,
so
I,
it's
and obviously, this is
the
why.
Reboot because it's about the reboot.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I love it. Love it, love it, love it.
For me, it's like, okay, it's just called Chip Cookie. Okay, Dark City. Okay, movie Dark City. I really like the movie Dark City.
Yeah.
Dark City is amazing.
Had someone say, this was being done in books this long ago, and there was this movie already did this other thing, basically, so there's nothing really new in this movie, and they thought they were being clever and smart about it. And I went out, well, yeah, I mean, movies are going to lag behind books by a certain amount. You're going to see stuff that was introduced in science fiction and books probably 10 years ago just finally make it into movies, okay?
Yeah.
And yeah, there's a bunch of different pieces that the other movies have done similar material, but here's the thing. A chocolate chip cookie is basically chocolate chips and cookie dough, right?
Right.
There's not a lot to it. But a really good chocolate chip cookie is still a good chocolate chip cookie. If it's material we've seen before, but it's well executed, it's well acted, it's well performed, it's entertaining, there is value in that, even if it is not breaking brand new ground and doing stuff that was never done before. And frankly, there's some stuff that was, okay, my God, this is amazing, super groundbreaking, never done this before. I'm like, yeah, they never did that before the movie, but they also kept walking into the furniture and missing their marks.
Yeah. Now, these are the questions that were being asked back in 72, right? Mm. They were having conversations very much like this, because Sean Connery in 1967 is very different from 1973. The swinging 60s, the Cold War era, had changed very much by 1973. There had been assassination. There had been violence.
Malaise.
Exactly.
Inflation.
We had hit the first gas crisis. as we, in which they reference in Diamonds Are Forever, right? Times were very different. This was written in 72. If you haven't watched them, if you've got the DVDs, the Blu-rays, there's a little mini documentary on each one of these that covers the production of the film. And they do tend to be very positive, upbeat, and more box office records yet were broken. That doesn't make them not worth your time. Tom Mankiewicz, the screenwriter for Live and Let Die, talks about how there had been like a rising racial consciousness in the United States at the time. You had the Black Panthers. You had the rise of blaxploitation movies. And say what you want about the producers of the Bond films, they do very, very well at changing with the times. Sometimes they do this more nimbly, more agilely than others. Like License to Kill, Timothy Dalton's doing kind of like a Miami Vice kind of drug dealer story that comes off as kind of phony and dated as the years wear by. But Ian Productions is very good at keeping something essential about the character while flexing with the times. So we have Live and Let Die, and according to Mr. Mankiewicz on the DVD, Cubby came to him and put some books in front of him and said, which one of these do you want to do? And Mankiewicz selects Live and Let Die, because in his words, it had a little bit more of an edge to it. So they start on Live and Let Die. Their big problem is, what the hell are we going to do for a James Bond? Now, if you look at the DVD, one of the frontrunners at the time was apparently, like maybe like David Picker at United Artists, was interested in Burt Reynolds. Now, and Cubby was always, or I don't know, maybe Harry Saltzman thought that was a good idea. It's a little unclear, and I'm not sure, except that Cubby was against that. Cubby Broccoli was always very insistent that James Bond be played by an Englishman, that James Bond be an Englishman, British. Although I can kind of see where they're coming from with Burt, because he's got the swagger and the charm and the confidence, but he is fundamentally also an American actor. Now, according to the extras on this DVD, Roger Moore was friends socially with Cubby Broccoli and Harry Saltzman, the producers of the films to that time. They gambled at the same club and they became friends, and they finally called him up and said, do you want to do Live and Let Die? Further, Harry Saltzman on the extras said they had always had their eye on Roger from the beginning for the part. He was doing a TV gig when they were doing Dr. No, when they were doing On Her Majesty's Secret Service. He had a TV gig lined up. And this was, according to Harry, the first time that he had been available to do the part since the series had begun, and they signed him for it.
Shades of Pierce Brosnan.
Shades of Brosnan. And then that, yeah, exactly. And that they had their eye on Brosnan for many, many years before he finally got the nod in Goldeneye. So we finally get Roger in Live and Let Die. We've, of course, all very recently watched the movie. There will be a smallish elephant in the room. Not a huge one, I don't think. This film, I don't know. Just as there are certain issues regarding the portrayal of women in Bond films, that we're not the podcast that's going to cover that. We acknowledge these things, but there are other elements that we kind of focus on. By the standards of the year 2019 in which we record, there are elements of this particular movie that are probably kind of racist.
It's not really an elephant in the room. It's the entire Ringling Brothers and Bailey Barnum circus.
Yeah, really. As you watch the film, you realize that there are only two black people in the entire film that aren't in fact working for the villain. Like, all of Harlem works for the bad guy. Like, every black man in North America, and I assume a significant percentage of the black women, all work for the bad guy. Like, every black person you meet in this film, with the exception of two, are actively in the employ of the villain. The Bond films are trying to adapt to, like, the blaxploitation period, and they're trying to adapt to the times. There are elements of this film where they adapt very nimbly, and there are elements of this film where they do not adapt very nimbly. However, this is still a pretty good Bond film and a pretty good film. As Ray pointed out right before we started filming, there are probably 200 films, 100 times more racist than this from 1973, that nobody remembers at all. And this is a perfectly lovely film, and we remember it because we remember the Bond films. And if you want some debate on those particular issues, go start your own podcast. We're here to have fun with the Bond films.
As a note, this was going to be the second installment of our book club series, yeah, because Live and Let Die was actually the second James Bond book, right after Casino Royale. Eric got through the book first before the rest of us did and declared that it was way too racist
for us
to cover. So apparently the movie is, the book is worse.
Yeah. No, I'm watching the movie and I'm, you know, and it's been a while since I've seen it. I'm like, you know, and you remember you should kind of blur a little bit. About 15 minutes in, I'm like, do we really want to pull the pin on this? This is... Oh boy!
Now the book is racist, not because anyone involved made a conscious decision to be that way. I think it's just Ian Fleming is, love him or not, a product of his age. He's a product of his age. He's a product of his times. And the attitudes in that book are a product of the era that he lived in. That said, holy God! Oh my Jesus! Download it, read the first two or three chapters, and yeah, we just can't even. So, yeah.
So, just remember, whatever we're about to talk about is less racist than the book it was based
significantly,
on.
Significantly less racist than the book. Oh, Jesus.
The book was written when?
1952. Sometime in the
50s, yeah. So about a 20-year gap between the writing of the book and the filming of the movie.
And the book was actually written before Casino Royale was published.
Oh, that's
he had the deal for Casino Royale. It hadn't come out yet before he was going on and writing the next one. These things are just a product of their times. You wouldn't make this movie, you wouldn't write that book in this age that we live in, you wouldn't make this movie in the age that we live in. Times change, and sometimes they change for the better, and times have definitely changed for the better in a lot of ways. That said, this is still a pretty entertaining movie. This is still a pretty entertaining movie. I don't think anyone involved in it really has anything to be embarrassed by. Those of them that are still alive, anyway. So we start with the gun barrel opening. Dun, 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 bang! Gun barrel opening. We open in the United Nations building. There's a diplomat giving a speech. We pan by a row of diplomats, none of whom are particularly interested in the speech going on. We land on the English delegate who is, you know, listening. Then
he does look kind of half asleep.
They all look half asleep. God, I can't believe this guy's still talking.
Yes, apparently the Hungarian ambassador is very boring.
And why wouldn't he be? Now, we cut up to the translator's booth. There's somebody translating the speech, which I guess is in Hungarian or whatever, translating it live, and you see the diplomats all have their headphones. They all have their headphones on.
I wonder if it's good Hungarian. I was wondering, is it like actually a goulash recipe? He's just reading out there.
Could be.
Do we know any Hungarians? If you know Hungarian and if you know drop the DVD or Blu-ray in and let us know what he's saying.
Yeah, if you know Hungarian, let us know. Okay. So
this is apparently the English translator because he has a little board, much like we have here, with little plugs in it for all the different English speaking countries.
And someone mysterious plugs a red wire into the space for his headphones, and he's got some kind of plunger device on it.
For the UK guy, yeah.
Pushes the plunger, and you hear like this hideous, high-pitched sonic squeal. You see the English diplomat arches back and fall dead on the desk in front of him. Now, I don't know if they killed him with some kind of electrical charge through his brain or if they just used some kind of high-pitched sonic deal. Guy falls over dead. And then you pan over and you see Yaphet Kotto, the African-American actor you may best remember for Alien, and Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman. No, wait, I'm sorry. That's Jane Seymour. That's a very young Jane Seymour you see in this.
To clarify,
that is Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman.
It's Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman.
To clarify, this is not up in the translator booth. This is out on the UN floor. And
yeah,
right. I think the little nameplate for their country, you know.
San Monique. Yeah, we only see them for a second or two before we cut to New Orleans. And we see a guy in a gray fedora and a gray suit standing outside a restaurant called the Filet of Soul. S-O-U-L. And a funeral procession comes by, one of these apparently famous sort of jazz New Orleans funerals. And it comes by playing very slow, mournful music. And he's standing here and watching them come by. And
there's a weeping mother.
And then a shortish African-American dude with gray hair stands up next to the guy in the gray suit. Gray suit said, "Whose funeral is it?" And the guy says, "Yours," and then stabs him. The funeral procession drops a coffin over the body of the guy in the gray suit. They burst into joyous song and march on down the road. It should be observed that there are multiple passerby on the sidewalks in New Orleans around this restaurant, none of whom, in addition to the large quantity of people playing in the jazz band, are disturbed at this public murder.
Hydra would have trouble pulling this off.
Yeah, Hydra couldn't
pull this
off.
I guess if you were in Springfield, and, you know, it was the Springfield Marching Band, maybe you could pull that off. But really, I mean, it would need to be a company town. I mean,
yeah, it would have to be a company town, seriously.
And that's Spielberg for G.I. Joe, not Springfield for The Simpsons, for those who have just come to this podcast.
Yeah, I also was wondering.
That's Springfield, the Cobra-operated G.I. Joe town.
That is a crossover we need to see.
We desperately kind of do.
Homer Simpson ends up in the wrong Springfield.
In the wrong Springfield. I would pay. Chuck Dixon should write that. He wrote for Bongo Comics, too. Chuck Dixon should write like Homer Simpson in the Cobra Springfield. I would pay good money for that. And then we cut to the small Caribbean island of San Monique. And we see what amounts to a big wild-ass voodoo hoedown going on. And this is the part where I am not familiar enough with the customs associated with voodoo.
I'm not sure the writers were either.
I'm not sure the writers were either.
It's unlikely.
It's kind of this close to a big wild dance number. And so there's an Englishman tied up to a couple of stakes. And a dancer comes out. And there's like dozens of people. And it's at night. And it's this little voodoo village. And they threaten this guy tied to the stake with a snake. And the snake bites him and he dies.
Yeah, there's this guy wearing, is he wearing like a wolf head or
it
something?
It looked like a goat head. Furs
there's
and things.
There's some, a goat head. He's wearing a goat head, and he's very happily carrying a snake.
Well, I mean, he's carrying the snake. He's not about to be bitten by the snake. So in that situation, I'd be happy too.
And then he just keeps dancing around until the snake bites this dude.
Yeah, and again, this is, again, people are...
Voodoo does not work that way.
Yeah, I mean, again, basically people just doing wild, ecstatic wailing and bouncing around and capering around. And yeah, it's pretty much every stereotype about crazy voodoo wildness that from EC Comics, pretty much.
Pretty much, yeah. Now, having never seen any voodoo ritual and having no desire or ambition to see or be involved in it in any way, shape, or form, I don't have any experience to comment on this.
I'm just going to go out on a limb and assume that isn't the way voodoo works.
I'm going to be, I'm
pretty sure they don't kill people.
No,
there is a certain amount of possession by the Loa and so forth. Like that,
yeah, I don't imagine they
rolling
like,
around might have represented.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure tying people up to stakes and hitting them with that probably doesn't happen.
So now we cut to the title sequence, which is one of the classic songs, Paul McCartney, Wings, Live and Let Die.
Is this one of the first ones where the song was independently famous of the movie? I mean, Goldfinger kind of was, but it was also very noticeably connected to that specific movie, whereas I've heard Live and Let Die in contexts that have nothing to do with.
I think so. I think this is one of the very few that breaks out and has its own life separate from the film. So then we cut to Bond's flat.
Not a bad song.
No, I love it. And, again with the scary black people, the opening sequence is all dancing spooky black people with a lot of contrast between their skin and their eyes, and fire and skulls.
This would be the first James Bond title sequence with the naked ladies, where they're naked black ladies. See, we're evolved.
I think there's one naked white lady possibly representing solitaire, with at one point another woman's hands in a praying position to hide her butt.
Yeah. Did I ever tell you that my grandmother was totally scandalized by these things? I know I've told you guys the story before of how my grandfather and my brother and I watched Conan the Barbarian on HBO before. We also watched Bond films with my grandmother while we were being babysat, and she was utterly scandalized at the title sequences. Oh my gosh, you can see their boobies. My grandmother was totally scandalized by Bond, and my grandfather came back and was really, really enjoying Conan the Barbarian with us.
I'm pretty sure if you went to the people that were involved in the production of those credits and said, this scandalized my grandmother, they'd say, mission accomplished.
If
it didn't scandalize your grandmother, we were doing something wrong on the James Bond movie.
Something terribly, terribly wrong.
I mean, we need to do something more. What else can we do here?
I don't know.
Tentacles. That's what we'll do. Tentacles
next time. So we go to Bond's flat.
Right. We do not get Bond visiting the office this time. And they turned it on its head a little bit.
Also, we didn't get. Mm-hmm. I haven't gone back and done a study of which start this way, which don't. You don't get the Bond doing the little mini mission that's unconnected at the opener.
That's true.
Get the three murders.
That's true. Now, if you watch those extras, you see that you'll see them say that they were trying to differentiate this from Sean's Bond films. Mm-hmm. They were trying to do little things different to try to let you know that this was a different era now. And while you do have these things happening pre-titles, they are not that traditional mini mission. There are other things that we'll address along the way. So M comes to the house. He wakes Bond. Bond, who is, of course, with a beautiful woman, wakes Bond. It's like a couple minutes to six or something like that. And Bond gets his espresso machine out and makes coffee for the boss. And the boss tells him, okay, we've had these three killings we just saw. Well, we want you to go see if there's a connection and find out what's going on here.
At least two of them seem to be connected to this Dr. Kananga, who is the Prime Minister of San Monique at the United Nations apparently the specific diplomat that got killed at the United Nations was an agent there to watch Dr. Kananga while he was in the United States.
Yep. Right. Now, Moneypenny comes in and has the tickets and also has his watch from Q Branch, which is one of our big differences. Q isn't in this movie. Probably this is one of the ways they're trying to make it feel different from the movies prior. Q's not in the movie, but I can easily imagine a scene where, God, Moneypenny, it's like 4:30 in the morning. I'm not going to that man's house. But we have to deliver him the watch. You do it. I can kind of see Desmond's Q. No, I'm not going. I don't want to see that man right now.
Yeah, it is also 5:45 in the morning, and apparently this couldn't wait for Bond to come into the office. And one assumes Bond's phone is disconnected.
One assumes, yeah. Because that the beautiful woman happens to be Miss Caruso. Miss Caruso, an Italian secret agent, M says to Bond, oh, by the way, the Italians are very happy with that Rome mission. They are looking for their agent, Miss Caruso, however. Miss Caruso, who is currently slipping back into her dress in Bond's closet. Moneypenny, bless her heart, in looking for M's coat, notices that Miss Caruso is in Bond's closet, covers Bond with the boss. Bond goes to the closet, opens it. Miss Caruso is dressed, and Bond takes out the watch Penny is just giving him, which actually generates a very powerful magnetic field. Uses his watch to slide the zipper off the back of Miss Caruso for one more. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So now Bond flies to New York, and superimposed over that sequence, we'll find out it's Jane Seymour at Solitaire doing a tarot reading.
So this is, instead of traveling by red line, he's traveling by tarot.
Traveling
card.
By tarot. I wonder what Dr. Jones would say about that. I don't know. He's not traveling by red line. He's traveling by tarot. She reads what's coming up, and she says, "And violence and destruction follow him." And I say, well, thank God. That's what we're here for. Bond lands in New York. Taxi's there to pick him up. Like a CAA, I guess, runs its own taxi service. CAA guy drives him. He's talking on the car phone to his CIA friend, Felix Leiter, played by David Hedison, where we continue the tradition of rotating lighters in Bond films.
Did you notice on this one, they gave him kind of, I'm guessing, a Northeastern accent, and they kind of dialed it up to almost, but not quite JFK?
Yeah.
I mean, it was just sort of, okay, we need the Yankeest yank we can yank into this part.
Is this the guy that ended up playing Leiter twice, but like decades apart?
He's like the one guy that played Leiter twice.
Okay.
Now, I did look up, just to refresh my memory, I looked up Live and Let Die on Wikipedia right before I came over here, and the scene in License to Kill where Leiter gets mutilated by sharks
is originally in
Live and Let Die.
Right.
So he ends up actually playing his part from this book, but in a completely different movie.
Right. So the actor comes back to do the almost death of Felix Leiter scene, but in a completely different movie decades later.
And that's just one of those funny little synchronicities you get about this series. So he calls and he checks in with Leiter. You see a big white Cadillac. I think it's a Cadillac. You see a big
one. Felix actually refers to it as a white pimpmobile.
A white pimpmobile. And now, this car is being driven by a very large African-American gentleman.
Now, understand, for our younger viewers who don't follow cars, go look up what Cadillacs in the 70s looked like. These cars, they get gallons per mile. That's how they're rated in. And you can actually conduct flight operations for the Navy on the hood of them. Okay?
They are magnificent automobiles, like, the like of which you will never see
like
again.
It's like driving a super tanker, borrow a PG O'Rourke line. You know, that way if there's
a leaking super tanker.
Yeah, if an accident happens, it's at some great remove from you, so you don't really feel affected by it.
Yeah, if the front end of the car runs into another car, you've got a good 5 minutes to get out of the car before the shockwave reaches you in the driver's seat. So, and then this pulls up, and then there's a gadget in the right side mirror where the African-American gentleman, whom we will later know as the henchman Whisper, uses to shoot a dart in the head of Bond's driver. Bond's car goes wildly out of control because the driver's dead, and he's ricocheting around this New York highway trying desperately not to die, and then bam, runs into another car. And then we see like rescue vehicles and whatnot, and Bond calls in, "Felix, you know I don't like to cause you any trouble, but your driver's dead." Now, I do want to say that I think Roger and David Hedison had really good chemistry as Bond and Leiter in this film.
Yep.
I'm a little sad that they didn't bring Hedison back with Roger, because I thought they had a real easy rapport in this. I'm a little sorry we didn't see him again. Anyway, it turns out Felix is in fact pretty good at his job, is already surveilling Dr. Kananga. And we see Kananga and Dr. Quinn, medicine woman, and two of his people come into his office. And Kananga says something along the lines of, "Solitaire, take a letter." And he begins to dictate the letter and then switches on a tape machine to fool the audio surveillance that they are still there while they are changing clothes and preparing to leave. This is the part where Felix actually says, can somebody get me a make on a white pimpmobile? And then they trace the pimpmobile to a store called
Occult Voodoo Shop.
That's capital O-H, capital C-U-L-T, Voodoo. Occult Voodoo. And Bond goes in and starts checking out the Occult Voodoo store. And then the driver of the pimpmobile walks in, heads into the back. 007 slips back, follows him in the garage, and then sees Kananga and his entourage, including Jane Seymour, walk out, get into a car. Bond gets into another car, tails
them. Because
they
come down their hidden elevator from his office.
Right.
He grabs a cab. It's like a 57, 56 Chevy.
Yeah. Grabs a cab. The driver of whom works for, the driver whom we come to find out works for Mr. Big. They are tailed by other cars who work for Mr. Big. Various African-American people on the streets and sidewalks are phoning into Mr. Big to let him know the progress of Mr. Bond through Harlem.
Well, there's a shoeshine guy that has a radio in his shoeshine box.
Right.
Okay, and this is not cell phones. This is not being basic. This is apparently everybody Bond goes by, and there's like two or three guys following him. They're on the radio that James Bond is coming to Harlem. And apparently, you might as well put up a billboard.
Might as well put up a billboard. There's a traffic helicopter following him.
Yeah.
There's people with megaphones on the streets. So he goes into the Filet of Soul restaurant. Now, here we see another one of the significant differences between Roger and Sean. He orders bourbon in this movie. He orders bourbon, bourbon neat. He wants bourbon with water, no ice, bourbon neat, right? You would think, well, you're not going to get a martini shaken that stirred in the Filet of Soul in Harlem, but that bourbon is actually a deliberate choice. He drinks something different than Sean's Bond drinks. He also smokes cigars in this movie. You don't see Roger smoking cigarettes. Roger smokes cigars in this movie. And then I think in later movies, you don't see him smoke at all.
You don't see a lot of people smoke in movies later.
Well, we're still going through the 70s and the 80s. You don't really see it much at all anymore. They seat Bond in a booth. Bond spins around, and suddenly Bond is in the presence of the villains, because of course he's a white guy in Harlem, so been watching him for miles.
There was the neat bit where he orders the drink. The waiter comes up with his drink. Bond goes, you know, also I'd like some information on the side, and hands him a 20. And the waiter takes the 20, and then the hasn't handed him the drink yet, and then the booth spins around, he pockets the 20 and drinks the drink.
Yeah. And I thought, it's like, you take the money and you drink his drink. It's just like insult to injury. The booth swings around, and then we meet Solitaire. We meet Teehee with a big old hook for a hand, which is where I got the inspiration for Man Called Bond.
Yeah.
That was where that came from, where the henchman had the coat hanger hook for a hand. Yeah.
And this is our first henchman with, you know, very large henchman with some sort of mechanical bit. You have him, you have Jaws, you have Jaws. You had a run of very tall guys with mechanical bits.
Yeah, you always have the henchman. You always have the threatening henchman, but I think he might be the first with a mechanical bit. Mm. I think. This is another scene where Teehee, the henchman with the great hook for a hand, uses that hook to twist the Walther out of shape.
Yep. And this is not just a hook, it's like a pincer device.
It's like a pretty serious piece of hardware. And I think this is another one of those cases where Sean carries a Walther. Well, we're done with the Walther now. Mm. Sean drank a martini. We're done with the martini now. Mm. We're making deliberate changes in the text to let you know this is a different person. This is still a Bond film, but we're making changes because we're trying not to make overt comparisons between this guy and the last guy. I think the point is they're trying to create a new persona for him. We meet Mr. Big, presumably some sort of serious Harlem crime figure.
He is a stereotype blaxploitation gangster.
We also meet Solitaire, or more properly, we are introduced to Solitaire, who is Jane Seymour, who is just, and I gotta say it, oh my God, she's beautiful. And over subsequent decades, I think this is one of the cases where she has only actually gotten more beautiful as she has gotten older.
One thing in the credits, this said, and introducing Jane Seymour, was this her first film role?
It might be her first film role. The documentary on the disc says she was working on doing some TV work or something. Mm. This might be her first film part. Wow. So anyway, introducing Jane Seymour, and she's reading the tarot, and she's telling Bond, you've made a bad mistake, dude. And Mr. Big, the Harlem gangster, tells his henchman, take this honky out back and waste him. Nobody says honky anymore. Have you noticed that? That's probably just as well.
Probably just as well.
So they take Bond out into this absolutely grungy, destroyed, war-torn, it looks like a freaking Beirut in the 80s, which is probably what Harlem looked like in New York in the 70s. And they take him out into this alley where he's saved by one of only two African-American men in the film that don't work for Mr. Big.
He's actually already beaten the two guys up with a fire escape before Sutter shows up.
Well, I think that's true.
Yeah.
He didn't he?
This guy is one of the guys you saw on the car radio talking to someone reporting Bond's location. So you're supposed to think he's one of the legions of...
Because after Bond beats up the two guys with a fire escape, he appears in the distance pointing a gun at Bond, and you're like, oh, crap, there's another level of henchman.
But it turns out he's a CIA agent and works for Felix. He's an African-American. He doesn't work for Mr. Big, which makes him an anomaly in this film.
Felix sends them back to San Monique at this point.
Right.
Apparently, Kananga and Solitaire, Kananga and his entourage, apparently departed for
San Monique.
So Bond, on his private plane.
So Bond follows. He shows up at the hotel. This is the traditional checking into the hotel scene, which you get in a lot of Bond films.
And we're back in the Caribbean.
Right. Back in the Caribbean, like a lot of Bond films.
And we're introduced to Baron Samedi.
Baron Samedi.
Yes. Speaking of people who were in Annie and also in James Bond films.
And also pitched for 7-Up for many years.
Yes, he did.
So I saw this movie long after I saw the 7-Up commercials. I was like, oh my God, the 7-Up guy serves the devil. So, when I was a kid, that was kind of a shock. I didn't really see that one coming. So we show up at San Monique. Bond checks into the hotel. Apparently, Mrs. Bond has already checked in. And wait a second, Mrs. Bond is dead, isn't she? What happened here? Or is there a Mrs. Bond? I don't know. So Bond goes to his hotel room, draws himself a bath. He uses a little device to scan the room for bugs.
And they're all over the place.
They're all over the flipping place. And now I'm starting to get a vibe here. This movie reminds me a lot of Dr. No.
Yeah.
The book Dr. No was actually written more or less as a sequel to the book Live and Let Die.
Oh, right.
If you look at Live and Let Die, the book, Strangways, the agent who's killed at the beginning of Dr. No, is in Live and Let Die. Quarrel, Bond's sidekick in Dr. No, is first in Live and Let Die, right? So Dr. No was the film made first, but the book written second. And I do think it's very interesting that Dr. No was the first film for Connery. Live and Let Die, which has a lot of textual connection to Dr. No, a lot of similarity in locale and story, is the first film for Roger Moore. And it does make me wonder, Mankiewicz says that he just picked that book to start with, but it also makes me wonder if he wasn't consciously trying to, in our language, we would call this a soft reboot, maybe? Would we call it that these days?
Well, okay, probably we might. I mean, the thing with James Bond is they've been doing the changing out the actors periodically.
Yeah.
Every new actor is a soft reboot.
I would almost argue that every film is almost a soft reboot. There's really not a lot of film-to-film continuity in this
series. Up until you get to the Craig ones, I think.
Well, yeah, and the Craig ones tend to draw those threads a little tighter. So there are a lot of similarities between this and Dr. No. It's got the Caribbean locale, obviously. And it's got I would actually argue that Live and Let Die, the movie, has a more human scale even than Dr. No does. Dr. No, the film.
Yeah, I think they're trying to do a more grounded Bond here. It's a somewhat more pedestrian sort of threat rather than, you know, nuclear blackmail.
Pedestrian's not the right word because Bond's never pedestrian. Grounded. We're not
jamming nuclear missiles or prepare, you know.
Which we'll get to. I think Michael Wilson says they always start trying to do From Russia with Love and they always end up doing Moonraker.
Pretty much.
The arc of the films is they try to start grounded and then it just gets crazier and crazier and crazier until they make a conscious decision to pull it back. So this is Live and Let Die, and it's very much a human scale threat. It's a human scale plan. It's human scale villains. This is not even Avengers Infinity War. This is not even the first Avengers. This is a very grounded human man versus man kind of story. It's believable. It's got verisimilitude. Yeah, did I pronounce it right? Did I get that one right? Did I get it close enough?
Verisimilitude.
So anyway, we check into the hotel room and he's scanning for bugs, like Connery does in the early Connery films. And the threats here are like the villains release a snake into the thing. They don't suddenly have the walls of the hotel room like close in on him with spikes and whirling chainsaws. They try to kill him with a snake, like they tried to kill Connery with a spider in Dr. No, right?
Using exotic poisonous animals to kill someone, that's a staple of these things.
It also kind of draws some tighter threads to some of the 30s and 40s pulp fiction that we suspect influenced Ian Fleming in his writing. I don't know that Fleming necessarily read a lot of Doc Savage, but I think scholars are pretty sure he read a lot of what you call the Clubland heroes, your Bulldog Drummonds and people like that. So, and then the guy that was driving the pimpmobile, Whisper, brings in the champagne that he's ordered, drops the champagne off, and then Bond kills the snake with a cigar and a can of aftershave, which I don't know what that says about his aftershave.
It's a flammable compressed gas.
This bit never really gets brought up between them again, but someone with a gun slowly starts to come into the room, and Bond uses the same cigar to burn the person, so they drop their gun and then flips them onto the bed, only it turns out to be Mrs. Bond.
CIA agent Rosie Carver, African-American woman. This will be the first African-American woman to be a Bond girl. She's kind of a mess. She's a little bit of a mess. She's working with Felix. This is only her second mission.
Her first was with the guy that got killed by a snake.
Yeah, her first was with the guy that got killed by the snake. So Bond's like, well, yeah, I'm feeling pretty good about that. And they find, and I actually wrote this quote down because it just cracked me up. They find a small top hat with a feather and some blood on it on the bed in one of the rooms. Oh, I'm getting ahead of myself. Bond, of course, starts to throw moves on CIA agent Rosie Carver because, shit, this is Bond. All right? And she says to him, Felix told me there'd be times like this. And Bond says, what does Uncle Felix suggest you do? And she says, cyanide pills. And she says, failing that, I book two rooms. And then she goes, she makes a move to go into the other room where she sees the top hat, the little miniature top hat. Starts freaking out.
She's already freaked out once at the dead snake in the bathroom.
And now she freaks out at the little top hat, which we are, I think, led to believe is some kind of voodoo warning symbol, right?
It's like the black spot.
Roger describes it, you know, Roger's kind of blasé, but well, it's clearly a top hat for a small man of modest means who lost a fight with the chicken.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is like, it's a small top hat with like two white feathers covered in blood stuck into the hat band.
And it's just one of the best lines in the movie. I love it so much. And I think she ends up spending the night in Bond's room anyway, because this is Bond after all. They have breakfast. There's I'm a little fuzzy on this part. There's a tarot card included with breakfast, and I don't really know why.
It's a reversed Queen of Cups, and the two theories that we came up with are either Solitaire left it for Bond as a warning, or that was Rosie's orders.
I think it makes sense in the narrative, based on just the relatively brief appearance between Solitaire and Bond.
That's right.
Unless there was an alternate cut or scene that was dropped, I'm assuming that was meant to be instructions for Rosie.
Okay, that makes sense. That makes better sense to me.
But again, it's not immediately clear. Now, you know, Bond, you know, sees this tarot card and with their stuff, and then is seen going into some sort of local shop that advertises tarot cards for reasons we find out later.
Is it the occult voodoo shop again? Or?
I didn't check.
Did you notice the pattern on the back of the cards?
No. What is it?
007.
Oh, I did not notice
that. Oh, the circle. Oh, no, I didn't see that.
Yeah, I had to pause it. Did I see what I just saw? And, you know, but 007 on the back of the cards.
Well played, Eon.
Well played, guys. Well played. So Bond arranges their transportation. The mission for the day is to go where they found Baines' body. This would be the guy that was killed by the snake at the Voodoo Hoedown. And Bond retains them a fishing boat to take them out there. And the fishing boat is piloted and owned by a man named Quarrel Jr.
This is because, originally, this was the introduction of Bond's ally, Quirrell, in the book, who then gets killed off in Dr. No.
But they filmed Dr. No first. Since they filmed Dr. No first,
Quirrell has already been killed, so this is now his son, Quirrell Jr.
Right. So they take off on Quirrell Jr.'s boat, and they cruise by the island of San Monique, and they see a house on a cliff, and it's identified as, I think Quirrell says, oh, that's the house of the Kananga woman, by which he means...
Who has the Obeah power.
The Obeah power. And this is a little weird for Bond. We've learned by this point in the movie, she actually does see the future. Her precognitive supernatural powers are, in fact, real. Or they seem to be. Well, no, they're real. They're legit. She's actually legit telling the future. Or that's how I read it anyway.
Well, I think the movie is kind of... I mean, he clearly thinks she can do that. And the villain thinks she can do that. And it's like,
and
really?
She thinks she can do it.
Right. So it gets into kind of the whole... You're getting into that Indiana Jones territory of... Okay, yeah, that's just superstition, right?
Right, guys?
Okay, where are we going? Because this is kind of new and different for a James Bond movie.
Yeah.
It may be the only James Bond movie where it's James Bond versus the occult.
This is also a little bit representative of the times, because you look at films in the late 60s and early 70s, more occult sort of topics are creeping in then, too.
My wife described it once as the high watermark of woo, or just high watermark of weirdness.
Something like one of those, yes.
Yeah,
because if you think that there was a lot of... Yeah, when I was a kid, even though I didn't live through very much of the 70s and was still in single-digit ages by the end, even I could tell there was just this weird sense in the air that, like, any day now, UFOs and Bigfoot were going to turn out to be real, and we just had to adjust ourselves to that.
Yeah, UFOs and Bigfoot, and not to mention like tiki dolls and Hawaiian vacations.
Right. All narrated by Leonard Nimoy.
Yeah, as God intended. Although, as a sidebar here, we've all determined that Giorgio on Ancient Aliens is in fact a Centauri, right?
Yeah,
we all know that, right? That's not a mystery, right?
Yeah, okay. No, I mean, look at his hair.
But anyway, so they move up to the island. They're looking at the Kananga woman. They're looking for the house of the Kananga woman. And then
was it called again? The Umra power?
Obeah.
The Obeah power. Yes.
Yeah, for those who are wondering why Ray seems to have suddenly forgotten a word that was said a moment ago, that's because there was a giant 20-minute Babylon 5.
There's a whole 25 Babylon 5 there, yeah. So anyway, and then we cut to Solitaire, who is reading the cards and says, he comes again. And,
by water.
And boy, Willie. I'm sorry.
No, she does not say that.
Roger.
It's implied.
It's a Roger Moore Bond film, and I feel totally justified in the single entendre.
Because she turns over a card, and it's the lovers.
Yeah.
And Kananga's talking to her on the phone, and it's like,
What do the cards say? What do the cards say? And she's like shocked. She turns over the card. It's the lovers. And it's a Bond film, so we all know where this is going.
And
kids.
I think they'd done a bit with that card before.
Yeah,
she turned it over.
That's why I thought maybe the tarot card was from her, because when she and Bond first met, she turns over the lovers in her reading, and he's like, huh, us?
And she's like shocked and horrified for reasons we will come to find out.
Right.
And then Kananga's, of course, like, is it death? Sure, it's death. Why not? And then as they come in, he says,
it's the tarot card for mild inconvenience.
It's the tarot card for sinus drainage and, you know, athlete's foot. And then Kananga says, Rosie has been more efficient than I was expecting, wherein we find out that Rosie is apparently a double agent.
We have already met the two African-American people in this movie who are not working for the villain.
Yeah, this is spoilers. Yeah.
That spoilers, would be Agent Sutter of the CIA and Quirrell Jr., who is Bond's personal friend.
Right. So Rosie and 007 go into the jungle. Remember, the mission here is they're supposed to go find where Baines' body was found, right? To try to pursue the mystery. And they go in there, and they apparently have a picnic and a snog. And Bond says, it's time you told me the truth, Rosie. And she's like, what?
Because she's driving him down into a valley when it's supposed to be up on a hill, because nobody ever goes up on the hill.
Nobody goes up on the hill.
Right. And so he's like, didn't you say it was up on the hill and not down there? And she's like, yes, it's up on the hill down there. And so he starts to notice
discrepancies.
Something is wrong here. So I'm going to suggest, since we have all day and we're not on a deadline and she's not actually leading me into an ambush or anything, clearly we should just go on a picnic first.
We got some food in the back. You know, I like sex. So they go down there and she's like, what? Double agent? What are you talking about? And Bond's like, tell me the truth or I'll just kill you.
He mentions the significance of the tarot card they found in like their morning breakfast.
Reversed Queen of Cups implies a deceitful woman.
Yeah, and then Rosie sees some sort of voodoo statue, scarecrow deal in the trees.
Actually, there's a perfect line there where you see Roger Moore as the James Bond from the books.
Yeah.
Because he says, you couldn't kill me after we did that, and he just sort of puts the gun a little closer to her head and says, well, I certainly wouldn't kill you before we did that.
I certainly wouldn't have killed you before. Whoa.
And at that point, just says that, and again...
And she actually like gives him a little kick or something for saying that.
But that's the thing. I mean, at that point, yeah. We realize, okay, yeah, this is where Roger Moore can show...
He's still pretty hard.
This is where you see the cold-blooded bastard from, you know, from the books.
And you kind of see it a little bit in For Your Eyes Only, which is one of the reasons I enjoy that so much, like when he kicks Locke off the cliff.
Yeah.
So Roger can play that moment.
Yeah.
For
all the reputation of, oh, this is he's the funny, quippy Bond. He's, you know, he's basically the comedy relief Bond or whatever.
And Spy,
he's not.
He's really not. Spy Who Loved Me and Moonraker get very elaborate and get very kind of silly with their extremes and the space stations and the submarines and the boats and the bases and whatnot. They lean very hard into the fantasy elements. They are not realistic movies at all. But Roger can, and there is more humor in these movies, but Roger can and does play the darkness of it.
Yeah.
He can and he does.
Rosie is really freaked out by the idea of confessing. Yeah, yeah. And also she keeps seeing the voodoo scarecrows, which we've seen before that the Baron Samedi had or whatever freaked her out. So she's apparently really superstitious about this.
Yeah.
Bond thinks it's an act. It's apparently not really. She gets to the point of wanting to confess rather than be shot by him. So she just runs off into the woods. And then one of the other scarecrows turns out to be some kind of weird sniper scarecrow. It's got lens eyes and a shooty mouth. And shoots her, so Bond finds her dead.
Yeah, no, and I'm wondering, is it because she's superstitious, or the very dangerous person she's actually working for sends little messages with voodoo cards and is perfectly willing to kill people, feed them to alligators, and do horrible things to them.
Okay, so she also knows that the voodoo thing is something that Kananga uses.
Yeah, so, true, I mean, so. Whether she's afraid of the devil or Kananga...
Mm-hmm. Basically, I mean, the same thing.
Yeah, basically one and the same. And frankly, frankly good reason, because apparently Kananga's kind of annoyed because the trap was set. What happened? Well, we had to kill her because she was about to spill the beans. Mm-hmm. And he is annoyed at Solitaire at this point.
Right, because he said, you saw death. And she's like, well, I must have seen the girl's death. You have to ask specific questions. She's trying to play it off. And we get the hint that her powers have something to do with her virginity here, because he is like, your powers serve me, and when they are no longer useful to me, then I will take them away myself.
Oh, that's also that you basically currently get, like, the voodoo tarot card Cerebro thing.
That was cool.
Because she's, like, in this really elaborate headdress and this robe or whatnot, and then when she goes to stand up, when they kind of start arguing back and forth, the table splits down the middle and the headrest lifts up and she's...
So she's like Mecha Padme Amidala.
Yeah, it's weird. I mean,
totally did not notice that.
Yeah.
I did notice that when she's really doing her tarot thing, she's got like the original series Star Trek alien actress eye makeup.
Yeah, she's got like this weird gold eyeshadow also. And I think at this point, she has like a snake painted on her head. Gold and green metallic.
Kind of like the gold and green snake that Snake Guy likes best to kill people.
I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, it's a yellow and green snake. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Good catch.
So Bond approaches the Kananga house by hang glider, like one does, kicks a guy off the cliff.
Head. Yes.
Kicks a dude in the head, gets off, rips off his like dark camouflage hang glider pants, takes off his blazer, turns it back around because it's the 70s and blazers are reversible, walks into the house, Natalie attired.
No, it's now matching. It matches the pants.
Mm-hmm. That's what I'm saying.
It looks like he's like in some sort of commando outfit, and then it's kind of like the, and that's kind of a take, I think.
Kind of like the wetsuit thing.
The wetsuit that has a tuxedo on underneath.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's kind of interesting the ways they are trying to make sure that we're not trying to have Roger imitate Sean. They're trying to give him bits and pieces with the drink and the gun and whatnot where he's not imitating Sean, but they are doing callbacks to other movies to remind you that this is, in fact, a Bond movie.
But also, by the same token, this is Bond is going to be calling on a young lady. He's not going to wear web gear and BDUs or whatnot. No, he's, you know, tie, you know.
Although Dalton did that, and he pulled it off really well.
Well, yes, but I mean, this is the thing. He's going to basically, you know, it's like he's going on a date. He all but shows up with flowers.
And if he had had time, he probably would have got those, too. So he goes into the house, he finds... He
goes to the house that's described as solitaire.
Yep. Solitaire. So he goes in there, he finds he finds precognitive Dr. Quinn, finds her in there, and convinces her to sleep with him.
Okay,
But this is how.
Well, you believe in the cards. Yes, I believe in the cards. Well, they won't turn you on, and he proffers this tarot deck, and he just spreads them all, and just draw any card.
She draws the card, and the card is the lovers. So she draws the card, and she's like, oh my gosh, I guess I'm asleep with you now.
And they get all smoochy face, and the camera pans down.
And Roger has dropped a deck of cards that is nothing but that card.
So apparently when he went into that tarot shop to find out what the Two of Cups inverted means, he apparently bought out every single tarot deck in the place.
In order to make an entire deck of the lovers.
Yeah.
Yes, because he always has a plan. And so after he sleeps with her, she knows Mr. Big is going to be pissed. Kananga is going to be pissed. So she's got to make her escape.
Right. Well, because she reveals at that point, and she's really freaked out by this. It's almost like she has literally lost one of her senses, because when she loses her virginity, she loses her powers. Her mother before her, her grandmother before her.
Yeah, there's this great line, and Bond thinks she's talking about losing her virginity.
Right.
And he's like, well, yes, this happened. You're visible evidence that
your
happened.
Mother lost her virginity. Yes.
Right. And Bond is a little bit thick in this scene. It's not quite clicking. Oh, wait, she just lost her psychic powers.
Right. Well, also, or at least she really believes she had and has now lost, and can't even give him practical information from being Kananga's gun mall about his operation, because it all came from the cards.
Okay. Right, and so Bond is thinking there, just thinking, you know, the dressing gown is going to get from him realizing, oh, so you had a precognitive clairvoyant asset you could have delivered to MI6.
And you broke it.
And instead you screwed her.
Well played, Bond. Well done.
Well done. Excellent. Well done, Bond.
So I imagine I'm pretty sure that part got omitted from his report.
Yeah, he doesn't report. He doesn't type that part in, no. So he does convince her to show him
Voodoo Land.
Voodoo Land, right? Mm-hmm. Voodoo Land, which is definitely not the new Disney theme park.
She doesn't know what it is. Or she
says she's never been there. But this is up on that hill, apparently.
But she's looked at it with the cards, and it's great danger and great wealth.
Yeah.
Yes. Riches. Oh, there are great riches there, and you will die. And he says, we will die, because he's been teaching her the rules about being lovers. And lover's rule number 2 is apparently you stick together until death do you part.
Thereabouts.
Right. Or thereabouts. He teaches that, but that's not really his. Yeah, that's not really how he does
things. And then
she's
like, before we go, is there time for lesson number 3? And he's just been putting his pajamas back on.
His pants back on.
And he just starts taking everything back off. Say it. Well, somebody has to say it.
Well, there's no sense in going off half-cocked now, is there?
I'm not going to say it, because I'm going to blush too hard to mix the show. Okay.
So they go down there and...
The number of almost F-words that get said in this movie also.
It's a little startling,
isn't
it?
Especially when they get back to Harlem.
Yeah. So they don't go back to Harlem, do they? Do they go back to Harlem or New Orleans?
New Orleans. They go back to New Orleans.
So they go down there, and turns out what Dr. Kananga is, the voodoo operation is covering, is for fields of poppies. Mm-hmm. He's growing poppies. Okay. Someone out there in podcast land, raise your hand and tell me what poppies, why do we grow poppies?
To make heroin.
There we go. And then they're attacked in the poppy fields. Kananga gives the order that Bond is to be killed at any cost, but don't harm the woman.
So you get the obligatory, they're strafed by helicopter. And
they're
then
strafed
they...
by helicopters, and then they apparently escape in a double-decker
bus.
They just
sort of hide in the brush. They end up somehow in a little village, and the cops there, of course, all work for Kananga.
Yeah. Well, because he's the president of the country.
Because he's the president.
And that's actually more reasonable, because they may not even actually be bad people. They are working for the legitimate state of San Monique. I
mean, well, to the extent that San Monique may or may not be a kleptocracy with literally a James Bond villain as the head of the country.
Actually, we don't address the inner workings of state of San Monique. For all we know, Dr. Kananga actually runs a perfectly lovely country.
Or he's Papa Doc Duvalier.
He's probably Papa Doc Duvalier, but the film doesn't actually address
that. Isn't he Dr. Kananga?
Yes. He is Dr. Kananga. You know, is this like Latveria, where the people of Latveria love Victor Von Doom?
Of course people of Latveria love Victor Von Doom, if they know what's good for them.
I don't know. I've always got the impression that the Latverians legit love Doom.
I get the impression they love and fear him. And by that, I mean fear him.
Do they have civil rights on San Monique? Do they have, I mean, what do they do? What's San Monique like? Are the populace well fed? Do they have clean water and sanitation?
Did they look like they were well fed or had clean water and sanitation?
Well, we didn't really get a full look at the island of San Monique. Maybe he's actually a perfectly lovely island dictator.
There's debris and refuse on all the roads.
He gives speeches at the United Nations that sound really...
Yeah, it's
hopeful
basically, it is Papa Doc Duvalier, basically.
Basically.
You go look there, and they're trying to say Third World Caribbean Hellhole.
Third World Caribbean Hellhole,
visual vocabulary we've
but
got
But I think
here.
When we first see him at the United Nations, he's supposed to be like one of these advanced, I guess not African, but Caribbean presidents. That's the impression he gives to the rest of the world.
I think they're kind of like going off the whole non-aligned movement and such. Because, okay. if you listen to the... As Felix describes it, him knitting a flag as he's going and dictating that letter about this, that, or the other. There's various sops to that sort of thing there.
So more that they're going to be independent of the superpowers.
To the extent that James Bond movie really gets into actual geopolitics versus just this is a convenient backdrop to have a car chase. Or in this case,
a bus chase.
I gotta say, this is a really lo-fi action sequence here. I respect all the stunt work involved. These are real people doing real things. I don't think there are even any wires. It's just stuntmen wrecking cars. All right. Or a bus, as
how
the case
may
be. How
they got a double-decker bus to do a bootlegger turn. That was kind of impressive.
That is on the documentary. They just had a guy get out there and just... I think they actually brought in like a stunt driver from London.
The fact that it didn't go fall over. And the other question I'm wondering
is... You know who was legit on that bus while they were doing that?
Who?
Jane Seymour.
Wait, seriously?
Seriously.
Because we were wondering, watching that. Okay, so who's the stunt double whose jobs kind of look like Jane Seymour and don't get
Jane
bruised
Seymour.
Too badly?
It was
okay.
Jane Seymour. She
wow,
did it.
Wow, there is no way the underwriters would let you do that today.
No, no.
No, we need a stunt double over there. Does she have a twin sister? Okay, fine. Great. Actually, wait, no, don't use the twin sister because she does break her leg. Maybe we can use her to do the completion bond. Maybe, okay, no. So...
Yeah, it was straight Jane Seymour on that bus.
Okay, because I just assumed it was a stunt woman or something. They actually, okay, that's crazy. Wow.
That's cray cray. And then the documentary, she was just kind of shaking her head. Oh my God, I actually did that. Yeah, so she actually did that. They escape the island. They meet. They get on the boat with Quarrel. They head back to New Orleans, right? And they get to an island. They catch a plane. They go back to New Orleans. They get out.
There is a bit though. So when
that was good. Yeah, that was a good line she had.
Well, no, there's a bit where Bond talks to Quarrel. Okay, we need to get to, you know, where's the closest place we can get to New Orleans?
Yeah.
And Quarrel gives him a location. And I think he says something to the effect of, "We could go over here, and that would be closer." And Bond says there was an agent who was killed in New Orleans, and Kananga is probably still wanting her back.
Yeah.
So there's the strong implication that he's using her for bait to draw out Kananga.
Yeah. He has just assured Solitaire that she's safe now. They're going to turn the whole thing over to the CIA. She never has to worry about this again.
And he's
then
actually
she goes to Quarrel, and he's like, "Well, we're going back to New Orleans because there's still the third part of the triangle there. We need to find out what's going on, and we know Kananga will still come back to Solitaire."
Yeah, this will draw him out. And so that's a bit more of that
cold-blooded... He's kind of a heel.
It's that cold-blooded viewing her as an asset, a playing piece to be used in the great game to achieve his end.
Oh, and then she has a great line. And when he asks her, "Where would you like to go, Solitaire?" And she leans back on the bed in the hold of Quarrel's boat and she says, "Anywhere that has one of these."
What?
And it's like, whoa, wow.
So, we know things are going to go wrong, however. At least it's not an extra evil black person in the movie. They get picked up in New Orleans by the same taxi driver that Bond had.
He has very prominent sideburns, and you see, that's...
And he's in good cheer.
Oh, he's in great cheer.
He's cheerful. "Hey there, Jim, how you doing?"
Yeah, he did have the great line back when he drove Bond into Harlem. He says, "You know where you're going?" Bond says, "Uptown." "You're heading to Harlem. You know, here's an extra 20 if you just keep up with that car." And he says, for $20, I'll take you to the Ku Klux Klan cookout."
Yeah.
You know, he's a happy, chipper.
Happy, cheerful, happy-go-lucky, love the guy.
Yeah, he's a henchman and driving Bond to his doom, but, you know, hey.
There's no reason to be ugly about it.
Yeah, that's, you know.
It's a perfectly lovely day, sun's out, we'll get the rate, turn some on the radio. There's no reason to be mean about any of this.
I end up at an alligator factor, whoever end up. I'm still giving you a one-star
review. Still giving you a one-star review on Yelp, but there's no need to be ugly about any of this.
So they go, because they got picked up at the airport. Mm-hmm. Now they're being driven to like a private airfield.
That's right.
Where they are going to be taken up in the air and thrown out of a plane.
Well, Bond is.
Yeah,
because I think the assumption is that Bond kidnapped Solitaire.
Oh, right.
Because
there's
a neat little bit where she...
Oh, right. They still don't want to hurt Solitaire.
Right. And she, like, hits Bond with her handbag or something and says...
And she says, "And my only regret is that I won't be there to see it."
Because she is
not stupid, and she's just figured out she was the bait.
Well, I don't know if it's that or she's covering to try to give Bond a window to escape.
Little column A, little column B.
Because Bond immediately starts beating people up and escapes.
Actually, this, I think, is the most 70s scene in all of Bond.
Okay.
This scene, for some reason, I feel like I'm watching like the North Avenue Irregulars or something like that. This is the scene that marks it as like a 70s movie in a lot of ways. For some reason, these are just my associations, right? Okay. He sees a single engine plane used for flying lessons.
The Bleecker Flying School.
The Bleecker Flying School opens the door, jumps in, and it's an old lady in big bug eye glasses. And all it's missing is like a big gong sound effect. Boing! She's like there for her flying lessons, and Bond steals the plane with her in it and leads Kananga's henchmen on a merry chase around the airport with
on
cars.
The ground.
Just on the ground.
On the ground.
I don't know if she's even learned how to take off yet.
And I'm assuming this is because the plane needs a certain amount of runway to take off, and Bond can't get the brake. So he leads them on a merry chase to the airport, and planes are destroyed, and cars are crashed.
I think the wings get ripped off.
The rings get whipped off the
there's
plane.
There's some bit where like the henchmen jump out, they've got a whole bunch of shotguns, they figure they've got Bond, and they realize he's driving a giant lawnmower right at them, and they die for cover.
For some reason, this is like it's the reaction shot of the lady in the plane with the big dong with the big glasses, and I'm like, this is the most 70s moment in all of Bond.
I believe she may actually say holy shit.
She says holy shit as she realizes the wings are getting ready to be torn off. So we have the comic relief old lady in the airplane. For some reason, this is the scene that just really feels like nails in my head. This is the scene that makes me feel, okay, now we're in the 70s.
Like the giant corkscrew jump in Man with the Golden Gun. yeah, the sound.
They did the slide whistle.
Yeah, the sound effect on that, which is, I mean, it's an amazing stunt.
It ruins the single best stunt of the 1970s.
Yeah, that is, and if we do Man with the Golden Gun,
which we'll get to next time we do Roger.
Go look up that stunt. That was one of the most sophisticated stunts ever done.
Yeah.
Car was modified. Computer simulation was used to figure out how to adjust the center of gravity and everything and get it all done.
Yeah.
And there's a great story about, and we mentioned another podcast where the guy that was going to do it wasn't there, so they had somebody else do it, and he did it, and Cubby Broccoli was there and like passing out $100 bills.
Yeah.
And the guy's like, are sure you got it? We could do that again.
All right. Where were we? So we have the comic relief old lady, the plane chasing the ground, that which Bond escapes from the villains, of course.
And then they pull up with no wings on the plane right in front of the flight instructor, who then spends apparently several minutes, we don't hear his end of the conversation, haranguing Leiter and the CIA over the phone.
We cut to Leiter in the hotel room, right? And this guy is, yes, Mr. Bleeker. No, Mr. Bleeker, there's no need for name calling.
Uncle Felix is smoothing over the fact that James Bond just destroyed an aircraft and part of an airport, just like he probably smoothed over with the NYPD, the fact that Bond was in a back of a car that...
That wrecked like 20 other cars with American taxpayers. We have a British agent smashing cars on the expressway, driven by American taxpayers, and the NYPD is none too pleased about this.
Do we mention the driver was dead? Because the driver was dead. The
driver was dead. And then Jill St. John had that great line in Diamonds Forever. Yeah, let me guess. You've got a friend named Felix who can fix anything. So Felix is like talking to poor Mr. Bleeker. There's no need for name calling, and we don't have to involve Nixon in this. In the same scene, you have Bond meeting with the tailor, which is like such a Bond thing to do, I suppose, because all of his luggage is still in that hotel room in San Monique, right?
That's going back to the opening of the movie, where Bond is trying to deflect M from, because M tells him, I'll brief you while you pack, and M sort of starts walking into Arne's bedroom, and Bond deflects him into the kitchen.
Because there is possibly a naked Italian secret agent in the bedroom.
Yes, yeah, so, and, you know, mentions about one of the agents was killed. Oh, I quite liked him. We shared the same bootmaker. You know, it's just sort of this rather British upper middle class tough kind of thing to say.
And it is interesting because there is a scene in the book where Bond gets outfitted by an American tailor, which is, I think, one of the themes of the book is some of the differences between American and British culture. And there are ways the suits are cut. There are ways your hair is supposed to be cut. There are lots of little things that Bond has to kind of deal with to pass as an American in Live and Let Die. So it is, and I don't know if it's deliberate, but it does speak to the character that he's talking to the tailor. Don't forget the double vents. I don't like that tie. It's a little too frantic. I'll take these three. So Leiter and Bond go to the Filet of Soul in New Orleans. Strutter is in front of the restaurant.
Oh, yeah. Well, Strutter was in front of the restaurant.
He was in front of the restaurant.
While they're on the way.
Yeah, on the way, Strutter's got the place staking out. You cut to Strutter standing in the corner looking at the same Filet of Soul restaurant we saw at the beginning of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then the jazz funeral comes by again. The identical jazz funeral.
Yes. Yes.
And they probably shot it on the same day.
Oh, certainly.
You mentioned it might.
I think some of this close up scenes of the crying mother
might well be the very same shot.
It's the same footage, and it more or less plays out almost exactly, almost step by step, same way. The exact same, mild mannered fellow stands next to him, and you see Stutter sort of look over at him, and then it's basically a close shot on a trumpet just sort of uplifting and changing the note from the somber to the happy dancing music, just like in the first scene.
So they don't show you Strutter getting stabbed, but Strutter got stabbed.
Mm. Yeah.
And picked up in a coffin.
Yeah. And then I think there's a line Felix has at one point about, hey, I hope Strutter's not laying down on the job.
Yeah, I hope he's not laying down on the job or something. So
they get there and can't find him. So they go in. Bond does not take the booth by the wall this time because he's been caught
by
that.
He had a bad turn once.
So they take this table up near the stage. And the singer comes out and starts singing the theme song to the movie.
Yep. Which may be the one and only time the theme song to a James Bond movie has appeared in the
in the text of the film.
And she's very noticeably singing Live and Let Die at Bond the whole time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think right when they get to the Give the Other Fellow Hell.
Because Leiter gets called away supposedly by a call from Sutter. And then.
So I think right when she gets to Give the Other Fellow Hell.
The table drops into the floor. So apparently not only is there a chain of Filet of Soul restaurants around the world, but apparently they are all booby-trapped.
Yeah. And then the waiters come in. Again, none of the other restaurant patrons or anybody else.
Right.
So you go to White Castle, the only thing booby-trapped is the food, all right?
So, and then they swoop up, bring a whole new set of tables, chairs, a replacement set of drinks, and Leiter comes back and wonders where Bond has gone, and the waiter says, I guess misdirects him. And so down we go into the basement of the Filet of Soul restaurant.
Which is a lovely underground command center, where we have Solitaire and we have Mr. Big, the Harlem gang boss, right? And Teehee with his razor-sharp iron hook. And Mr. Big says to Bond, did you mess with that? Pointing at Solitaire, right? And I'm like, you understand you're in a Bond movie and she's an attractive woman, right? Do you even... Have you even seen one of these before? Do you even know? I mean, what? Well, did you not do your research?
Bond, of course, defers.
I reckon that's between me and Miss Solitaire, pal.
And Kananga. He's willing to talk to Kananga, but he keeps talking down to Mr. Big, who he presumes or is taunting as a henchman of Kananga.
Right. Now, it's interesting because earlier Bond wonders, well, what is the leader of a Caribbean island doing with a gangster?
Yeah.
And Leiter's take on it is, why is someone as big and dangerous and powerful as Mr. Big fiddling around with some second-rate island president?
Yeah.
You know, it's a complete, it's kind of that whole, you know, it's just...
Here in America, we consider crime in New York to be a bigger problem than who's ruling this island in the Caribbean this week.
So 007 keeps poking Kananga. Right. No, not Kananga. Keeps poking Mr. Big. Keeps poking Mr. Says Big.
I mean, not physically, yeah, because he's actually sort of in one of those little villain lair chairs where all of a sudden there's manacles swing around and lock you into the chair.
Why would secret agents ever put their hands on armrests anyway? This is always happens. Whenever you put your arms on a chair like that, there's always going to be handcuffs in it. Why would you?
Sleek, modern stainless steel furniture. I'll stand.
And so he keeps poking him. And then suddenly Mr. Big rips his own nose off, takes off the mask, and bum, 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 it's Kananga. Kananga and Mr. Big are one and the same. Apparently, Kananga having attended the Rollin Hand School of Espionage. And he still says, did you touch her? Because he wants to know. And Bond says, well, you know, a gentleman doesn't talk. And then they go through a whole scene where, all right, Solitaire, I got Mr. Bond's watch here. I'm going to tell you the serial number on the back of the watch, and you tell me if I'm telling the truth or not.
Or Teehee will cut Bond's fingers off.
Yeah.
He will cut his little finger on the first wrong answer, and on the second wrong answer, move on to the more...
vital areas.
Yes.
Or vital areas, by which I assume he means his pancreas or perhaps his lungs.
Yes.
I don't know. Probably talking about his pancreas or maybe his gallbladder or maybe his kidneys. I don't know.
Nope. Yes. Keep going.
No doubt.
Yeah, probably going to cut his dong off. Yeah. Probably. Thank God we didn't get that far. I don't want to see that in a Bond movie. So in the confrontation with Kananga, we find out the villain's sinister plan. He monologues a little bit. And truthfully, I dearly love Yaphet Kotto in this movie. He's charming and dangerous and intelligent and sophisticated. He's a really good villain in this movie. Like if you look at Matthew Almaric in Quantum of Solace, he's boring and uninteresting and kind of frog-like. But Yaphet Kotto is absolutely magnificent in this film. And he takes delight in explaining his plan to Bond because Bond's almost got it figured out, but not quite. See, Bond says, what we're going to do is, you're Dr. Kananga, you're the Prime Minister of the Silent Nation, you're also doubling as this crime lord, and you're growing poppy that you're converting into heroin and selling through a chain of Filet of Soul restaurants. And Kananga says, no, 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 Mr. Bond, not selling, giving it away.
And Bond runs over, like, that's... you know, however many tons of heroin you can produce out of those poppy
billions
fields.
Billions of dollars, yeah.
Because he says he's
going to give, 10 tons of heroin away for free.
And then he says, well, that's going to make a certain group of families pretty unhappy, don't you think? And Kananga says, oh, they'll be positively apoplectic, or whatever we're doing.
Out of their minds and soon out of the business.
Because you give it away for free, you double your market for junkies, you drive the other guy out of business.
He's going to Walmart the mafia, basically.
He's going to Walmart heroin.
And then once he's...
That's the first time I've ever heard Walmart used as a verb. He's going to Walmart heroin. That's good.
And then he says, and so when they, shall we say, the number of addicts in the country has, shall we say, doubled, just as an exercise, then, of course, we'll be increasing the price. Mm. You know, we kind of knew this when it was poppies, we knew it was heroin. The scope is perhaps a bit much, but this is a grounded Bond movie. This is about heroin. This is Bond does the French Connection.
Which, again, is the way the film is trying to speak to its times.
Then Kananga has them take Bond off and kill him.
Take him to the farm.
Yeah, it appears that Solitaire managed somehow to guess the serial number on the watch because he lets Bond... Well, he's still got to have Bond killed, but he doesn't have any parts cut off.
I interpreted that she didn't.
Well, no, but it appeared she thought she had gotten...
Oh, she thought she had. Okay, yeah.
Bond escapes with all of his pinkies.
Yeah, he does. But for some reason, Kananga doesn't actually cut the pinkies off because Solitaire has, in fact, lost her gifts because she boinked him.
So, yeah, then once Kananga and Solitaire are alone...
When the time came for you to see love, I would have given it to you myself.
He says, after knocking her to the floor with the back of his hand.
After backhanding her.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he explains, you completely failed the test. You are useless to me. And she's trying to say the cards told her to have sex with Bond.
Now, I think at this point... And it took me a while to realize, is this guy in the scene or not? Because there's a bit of a question about this. Mm-hmm. Then the door opens and unremarked, the Baron Samedi from the hotel show comes in, not wearing his Baron Samedi outfit.
The absolutely regal Jeffrey Holder.
Yeah, and he's just upbeat and smiling. And
wearing an extremely stylish suit and a big fedora.
And an ascot.
And an ascot. There are very few men that can successfully wear ascots. DeForest Kelly, Fred from Scooby-Doo. And Jeffrey Holder.
Yeah. He is totally rocking it and just is in just fine mood. And I guess Kananga says, there's only one way to deal with you. And he flips over the card and it's
death.
And
then we cut.
But it has to be at the appropriate time.
Yes.
And also, Holder start setting the cards on fire for some reason.
To be dramatic, I guess, because if you're Baron Zombie, you get to do shit like that.
Yeah. So we cut to Bond and the henchman taking him out to the alligator farm.
Yes, which is apparently where the name Kananga came from.
Right.
Apparently one of the, was it one of the stunt guys or
something? No, the screenwriter. They were doing a location scout. Right. And then this crocodile farm owned by a man named Ross Kananga is brought to the attention of the screenwriter. And it's and they're going to put it in the movie. And
it
furthermore,
has the sign that says, "Trespassers will be eaten."
And then they decide to name the villain after him. I think in the novel, Mr. Big was actually an anagram. His name was something, something, something,
right,
initials B-I-G.
B-I-G,
right. So the guy's name is Dr. Kananga now. And Teehee, the man with the iron hook, is very conversational as he's leading Bond through the crocodile farm.
Apparently knows a lot about crocodiles and the differences between them and alligators.
And also, in keeping with James Bond movie, it turns out the crocodile farm is actually a front for the heroin processing.
Right.
Because there's like a lab with guys in lab coats.
It looks like a shack from the outside.
Yeah, it looks like a shack, but inside it's like gleaming silver, and there's guys doing lab things in there, and they talk about, you know, the shipment needs to be ready for such and such, and apparently
tonight.
Yes.
They emphasize right before they're about to kill James Bond that this is going out tonight.
Yep. Tonight's the big one.
And Teehee is very conversational. I love the way Kananga's henchmen are cheerful and conversational. Teehee is like, well, crocodiles have this nose, alligators have that kind of nose. Some of these guys can go a year without eating. And by the way, I'm leaving you on a rock in the middle of this lake full of crocodiles that are going to eat you. Bye, Mr. Bond.
Also, this is old Albert, who's a really old crocodile and the one that ate my arm.
And it amazes me that Albert is still alive after eating a guy's arm. Why wouldn't you have killed Albert? I don't know.
Because he's very useful. They want him to eat people's arms.
The whole point is they want crocodiles that have a taste for human flesh, I assume, so that will eat intruders,
even if that means it's your own arm, I suppose.
He just says he got careless around old Albert and lost his whole arm.
So it's not his fault. It's not Albert's fault. I just got careless. So it's like he's in an abusive relationship with the crocodile. It's not Albert's fault. I didn't listen.
When dealing with wild animals, anomalies is true. They are not moral actors, and you are made of meat.
There
and
is
if
that.
If you put yourself in a situation where they start perceiving you as food rather than something else.
Like if somebody walks in here who's basically made of Cheez-It, would we be forgiven for eating the arm of the man made of Cheez-Its?
Animals are oral actors. Human beings are.
That's a point. Okay, fair point.
Cheez-Its are tasty, though.
Cheez-Its are tasty. What if we had a person walk in here who was made out of chocolate chip cookie? Could you?
In the general case, humans are moral actors. My co-hosts may not be moral actors, as it turns out.
Well,
who knew?
Chocolate chips are yummy. What
next on Existentialism Cast, we're going to look at Camus.
Okay, so, and then we have one of the great stunts in the movie, where 007 is being surrounded by crocodiles. He's about to be eaten, and he does this stunt where he bop, bop, bop across the heads of like five crocodiles to get to dry land. This was actually the farm owner, Ross Kananga, who was wearing Roger Moore's costume, and they actually had to do like five or six takes of this, each of which are on the DVD if you want to go looking for them. Because
and that's why he's in there as a stunt coordinator credit.
Oh,
right.
Okay, that's why he's got a stunt credit.
So Bond escapes, throws some raw meat out, leads the crocodiles into the lab, proceeds to set the lab on fire because screw you, you heroin trafficking assholes.
Also lets one alligator into the heroin lab so they all come running out. So he doesn't necessarily kill all the scientists.
Yeah, though he
just gets rid of all the heroin.
And you know, he probably would have been forgiven for killing the heroin scientists. You've got a license. These guys are selling heroin. Mm-hmm. Why are we being so nice about this?
Well, I thought the implication was they're not going to go out the entrance with the alligator in the way, and they will thus be inside when it catches on fire and explodes.
Ah, okay. Well, some of them did actually start running out, though.
I mean,
they're still surrounded by more alligators.
He's James Bond. He's going to try to spike the body count if he can do it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So Bond escapes on a speedboat, right?
And then there's this incredibly
the
long
longest chase in the movie. Possibly the longest chase in any James Bond movie ever.
And it's not a great chase. It kind of drags a little bit.
And there are a couple of periods where they focus so much on the chase boats that I lost track of whether James Bond was actually still in the chase or whether they were just
like
following each other.
Are we just hanging out in the bayou now? I don't know.
It was like watching Formula One. It's like, okay, yeah, Lewis Hamilton is so far out in front, that's not interesting, so we're going to focus on this midfield thing between like Sheriff J.W. Pepper and this other guy in this other speedboat.
You said the magic words.
Oh, yes.
You said the magic words. M.F. and J.W. Pepper.
Years before Smokey and the Bandit or the Dukes of Hazzard, the bizarrely racist, well, not bizarrely racist, probably, the rather racist and very southern Louisiana sheriff, J.W. Pepper.
He says boy a lot.
J.W. Pepper.
Okay. It turns out. Because there's a boat chase going on through his bayous, and of course, all of Mr. Big slash Kananga's people are in communication with each other, so they report this back, and they send a guy in a car to intercept Bond at the other end of the bayou, I guess.
I think there's the radio that, you know, Bond is escaping in a speedboat, and whoever catches him gets to live.
Yeah.
And it turns out, apparently, every speedboat operator and fisherman in all of Louisiana is actually Mr. Big's payroll.
Of course. So this guy speeds in a car to the location past Sheriff J.W. Pepper, and thus we introduce Sheriff J.W. Pepper.
Who makes one understand perhaps why all the black people in this movie are working for Mr. Big, because if your alternative is American life under the rule of men like J.W. Pepper, you sign up with Dr. Kananga, all right?
I have to admit, I think I've only seen the movie where he was more of a comic relief Southern guy, because yeah, he's really kind of racist.
He is horrendously racist. Turns out he's actually this very good-natured guy from New York, according to the documentary. Mm-hmm. He only passed a couple of years ago. Now, he's also used as comic relief in the next Bond film, Man with the Golden Gun. And he is also a Southern sheriff in Superman 2.
Oh!
Which gets me to one of my favorite little fan canon theories. Mm-hmm. I think the Christopher Reeve Superman movies take place in the same world as Roger Moore James Bond movies, because Clifton James plays basically the exact same character in Superman 2, and his name isn't given. They don't call his name.
He could be Pepper.
He could be J.W. Pepper, who's got sick of all this stuff with the British secret agent, moves to another quieter small town, which is then invaded by Kryptonians.
So I like it.
So in my head, Roger Moore and Chris Reeve involve the same space-time continuum as their characters. And it just makes me so happy in my heart. And I really want to write the crossover movie where Roger Moore, where like the Roger Moore Bond is like going on a case with like Clark Kent and Lois Lane. And then he's trying to seduce Lois Lane, and like periodically henchmen wind up dead around them. And Clark Kent's like, you can't go killing people. Huh? What? I'll probably never get around to writing it. And seeing as everyone involved is dead, there's no way the thing ever gets made. But it is a little fond thing in my head. All right, so we got this racist stuff, and there's this like, huge, ongoing, frankly interminable boat chase, and J.W. Pepper makes racist pronouncements.
It does at one point involve J.W. Pepper's brother-in-law, Billy Bob, who has the fastest boat on the river. So they try to get him in on the chase to catch Bond, but one of the Kananga henchmen knocks him over the head and steals the fastest boat on the river.
He's apparently following all of this on a police radio in his henchman car.
Yep.
It's the same guy. It was the guy that was in the car that was arrested.
Yeah, because what happens is
boat chase goes over the cars and crushes Pepper's car, but it doesn't crush that dude, so he just gets away.
Yeah, he gets away, and then. And again, just when you think, hey, the chase is going to be over because, oh, look, John's fuel tank
gets hit.
These boats
go through the air and on land. And
yeah, so, and you, like, Bond's fuel tank gets hit, and you think, oh, he's going to run out of gas, and then he crashes, and then he goes out of the water across somebody's yard, and the henchman gets stuck in these people's pool, and you think, okay, it's over, and then he apparently, Bond steals their speedboat, and the chase goes on.
And on. Although you do get to a very nice little exchange where you are reminded that James Bond will effing kill you if he has to. Henchman gets gasoline thrown in his face and he can't see. His eyes are burning, and Bond bumps his boat and steers him into some kind of ship where he explodes.
Yeah. It's like a tanker ship or something.
Yeah, some kind of cargo ship or some kind of barge or something. But yeah, they needed to cut probably about 10 minutes of chase. I guess it's kind of like some of the other Bond movies where, well, by golly, we paid for that helicopter. We paid for all those speedboats.
We're going to have it in the movie.
Yeah.
Harry Saltzman and Cubby, we paid for that shit. It's going in the movie.
They crash a wedding, literally, because these boats can drive for some time on land.
Yeah, they shoot out of the water and just skitter along.
They crush the wedding cake. The bride cries, of course.
And then I think after Bond kills the lead henchman who's in Billy Bob's boat, pulls up. There's Felix and some more Louisiana State Patrol, and Sheriff Pepper pulls up in a wrecked up car.
And he does, in all fairness, not to excuse the utter racism of the character, I'm horribly amused by J.W. I can't help it.
Yeah.
I'm horrified. He's horribly racist, and it's like, and I understand, but he amuses me tremendously.
Well, I think he's like, see, the captain of the State Patrol explains to him, well, he's some kind of British, you know, he's some sort of British guy working with our boys. He's some kind of secret agent.
On whose side? Are you some kind of doomsday machine, boy? I can't help it. On whose side?
that was great.
Yeah.
So then we've figured out that probably...
Felix's boys have raided the Filet of Soul restaurant
off
the camera. And they found these, and they found
the singed cards.
Three singed tarot cards, which are Death, the High Priestess, and the Moon. And from this Bond intuits, they're apparently going to do some sort of voodoo sacrifice at midnight.
With Solitaire.
Yeah.
So we head back to San Monique.
And this is the part that I'm thinking, you know, it's in the Caribbean. This is the point at which really, okay, the U.S. would just invade another Caribbean island because there's probably just a form for that. And
it's like a W-5-2. You just fill it out, send in some guys.
Yeah, it's like Grenada, bam, bam, okay, go.
Just go do the thing.
But apparently... Yeah.
But instead, they have to send in Bond and Coral, who I'm guessing is an actual CIA asset.
Or an MI6 or something. He could be MI6, could be
freelancer. No, he had like a secret spy cabinet on his boat that Rosie found.
I don't think he's a CIA asset because Rosie wasn't aware of it.
Oh, right, he worked for Bond.
You know, like, I think he's actually an MI6 asset.
That makes sense. So they are going to plant all of these bombs throughout the poppy fields. And as you pointed out, the bombs, which they are wearing on a belt around their waists, are timed to go off at exactly midnight, which it apparently almost is, rather than them having a button or something.
It goes off, in about 30, these will go off at midnight, which is about 30 minutes away. And I'm thinking, could we maybe have bombs that we can have go off 30 minutes later, or like at least 10 minutes later, or at least not just are going to go off if they're still on our belt, if for some reason we are delayed sneaking into the poppy field in, you know, Voodoo Land?
Yeah, one would think. So they sneak in and they're having another big old hoodoo vo down. Mm-hmm. Hoodoo vo down? Voodoo ho down.
Yes.
They're having another voodoo ho down.
Yeah, and they're voodoo is a totally other like Appalachian thing.
Totally different deal. And then they're going to sacrifice solitaire, right? Mm.
And they start doing the snake dance guy, but he doesn't actually kill her. He like gets really close to her with his favorite snake. Oh, this time he's got a coffin full of snakes to choose from.
Yeah,
this becomes important.
There's a boa constrictor in there that probably weighs more than Jane Seymour.
Yeah, and can I just say again, she is just.
She is just so hot here.
She pulls back
just before letting the snake bite her, and then they have to do a summoning ritual for Baron Samedi, and the dude literally rises up from a grave.
Yeah. So
like as though on an elevator, as we've
and got. So yeah, you have basically this. These I think it's three people come out very. Somberly, everybody gets quiet, carrying this sort of gray top hat.
With the bloody feather.
Yeah. And they set it on this grave, and then they do some sort of, with a machete, clang, 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 with a machete, and then, shoop, Baron Samedi rises up out of the grave.
Rises up out of the grave.
Just shoots up out of there, and the top
hat's
around top of his head.
And this time he's got the full, like, literally he has an entire skeleton painted on his body.
Yeah, the skull mask face paint, and...
He is a magnificently sinister figure. He's amazing.
And so there's a Bond, and I think Bond was trying to figure out what, you know, as Solitaire is being menaced, Bond is, you know, kind of... starts taking aim at the snake guy, and I don't think he quite shoots.
No, he doesn't shoot then.
Because they back off and apparently aren't immediately going to kill her, and they're still...
And also
he
keeps checking his watch, and it keeps getting closer to midnight.
Yeah, and there's like a million cultists here or whatever, so... Mm-hmm.
Now, I do want to say that I think Roger Moore looks really cool in this scene, because he's got like this big shoulder... He's wearing all black, black pants, black turtleneck, and he's got this sort of brown leather shoulder holster. And is that a 357 he's carrying?
It's a giant 357 Magnum.
That's why I thought so, which is another case.
I think it's a Colt Python, but I haven't checked yet.
Which is another way of adapting to your times, because this is also the era of Dirty Harry.
Mm-hmm.
We're not carrying some wussy little Walther. We got a 357, all right? So this is another case, I think, of him adapting to his times. And he just looks, he looks cool. I love that outfit on him. What can I say? So he rescues Solitaire as the fields go up.
Right, well, so he shoots...
He shoots Dumbala, the snake guy.
Right.
First, and he shoots Samedi, who's standing on his little platform, and it chips apart.
Well,
like,
the thing
it's
is,
not
like,
really
it
Samedi.
Looks like initially, like, they blew the side, I mean,
side
your first
of the
thought
guy's
is,
head
blew the side of head off, and
the
guys roll
move.
Up.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm like, oh my god, did they just blow somebody's head off in a James Bond movie? And like,
and you see
really
it, and you see his eyes move, even after the side
and
of his head's blown off.
And then he shoots him again, and he just falls apart.
Right, so
he's some kind of dummy.
It's like a plaster statue, so I'm like, okay.
Or was it?
Well, right, no, because it gets weird.
Yeah, but
this gets weirder.
Yeah, so
I'm going to say, or was it? Because we're dealing with some voodoo here.
So well, now that the fighting has started, the explosions go off, people are running around, and the real Samedi rises up
from the exact same spot.
Right,
and he and Bond get into a machete fight, and then Baron Samedi, who this time is apparently not a giant plaster mannequin, ends up face down in the coffin full of snakes. You can guess how that goes.
Yeah, writhe, chop, chop, writhe, writhe, coffin closes.
He twitches a little bit.
He twitches, then, writhe, 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 ominously just stops. Mm. You know, so he's dead.
So Bond grabs Solitaire, taps the machete on top of the grave.
Right, and
ding,
so this
ding,
is
ding.
The bit, yeah, he runs up to the grave and clang, clang, clang on the tombstone and cut down. There's a henchman.
And a lair.
Mm-hmm. And he hits
lair,
a button.
And a lair.
It's a little elevator. That's how he got up and down.
Now, for all the changes and for all the differences and adapting to times, this is like the part of the movie that says, okay, we're in a Bond movie, here's a lair, all right?
And it took me a second to realize, all of the henchmen are wearing red shirts and blue jeans.
And there's a monorail.
Yeah.
There's a monorail.
So, like, you know, they come down, Bond takes out the elevator operator, and someone on the other side of a glass window notices, wait, there's James Bond is in the headquarters, and presses a button, and there's an alarm, and more henchmen in red shirts and blue pants come running in with machine guns and rifles and running around trying to get James Bond, and they hide in these little tunnels, and there's this cave network, and they find this door, and it's this big stainless steel door, and they come inside.
Stainless steel.
And on the other side of the door is...
Dr. Kananga.
And this,
and he's wearing a Nehru jacket, and he's got a little scarf, and he's, hello, Mr. Bond, and he's in a good mood, and oh my God.
He's not at all disturbed by them apparently destroying every piece of the heroin
and apparently,
processing fruition.
And apparently this really reminds me of an early, I think, is it Thunderball? There's a similar set with Blofeld on there, where it's, you know, kind of this multi-level thing where they kind of, it very much reminds me of, this is a James Bond lair. And he's in a good mood. Well, poppies are hardy plants, and you know, I guess you've only mildly inconvenienced me, Mr. Bond.
I think he's actually more than mildly inconvenienced him, but he doesn't want to admit.
Right, right. Fair. He does reveal that he has this heroin delivery monorail, where you put the heroin in these rocket-shaped capsules and drive it around on this monorail.
Yeah, so it's
through
a secret lair.
Underground lair.
It's like, we're trying to do a James Bond. We're trying to do a grounded James Bond movie. We're trying to, you know, just address modern issues. And then there's a lair with a monorail and sharks.
And then we can't help it. It's a lair and there's monorails and sharks and a villain and a Nehru jacket. Yes! And it feels good.
And so... Apparently, so at some point in this, you mentioned that they'd cut back to Felix and Quarrel on the boat, and Quarrel says, well, his wetsuit was gone, where they deposited after they'd swum ashore, so he must have made it out.
Yeah.
And apparently...
No doubt he got tied up.
Yeah. So...
Which we, of course, cut back to Bond and Solitaire tied up to a frame and getting ready to be lowered to the shark.
And so a shark.
Apparently, Quarrel's means, you were most unfortunate that your wetsuit was discovered by my men, Mr. Bond.
Yes.
So, that so apparently that's... And I'm assuming Felix is assuming, oh, Bond and Solitaire are probably off on some, you know, inflatable life raft somewhere else. And
he's probably snogging her on a life raft somewhere.
Right, so that's
what always happens.
We'll find her, and we'll have the intern hose off the raft.
Yeah, so, I mean, Felix is thinking, we're at the end of the movie here, and then I guess around sunrise or so, the search helicopter will find them.
Yeah, but we're not there just yet.
Not quite. Yeah.
So Bond's, he's about to be lowered, and he's tied to the girl, and there's sharks, and it's going to be awful, but he's wearing
the watch.
Oh, wait, we should mention, there's...
Oh, the shark gun?
Yeah, so apparently there is, you know, and Kananga's just in this marvelous, magnanimous mood, and, you know, this, you know, Mr. Bond is just endlessly delightful, and just all of your wonderful things. Like, what is this thing? And it's this weird-looking pistol. It's like, that's a compressed gas shark gun. So he turns around, and there's Whisper sitting on a couch there, and Whisper gets this uh-oh phase, like, oh, he's going to off the henchman just because. And he shoots the couch, and the couch, like, blows up like a giant balloon.
Like, inflates and goes pop.
And right? Kananga thinks this is the funniest thing ever. He's, just, you know, you think he's going to be just like, I must have one of these. Yes.
I want a gun that makes things inflate and explode.
And then apparently there's, what does this thing do? And I guess it must be a spare ammunition.
It's Bond's, the pellet.
Yeah, and he's like, no, don't, Bond says.
Don't open that. The air is bad enough in here as it is. Don't open that.
And then, you know, Kananga's like, oh, Mr. Bond, there's no need for that. And
yeah. And so as they're hanging on the frame, about to be lowered to the sharks, and, you know, Kananga has cut Bond's arm, so he's bleeding, and so the sharks will get, blood, I'm hungry.
Yeah.
And then he uses the magnetic watch to draw the gas pellet over to him. And then it turns out the little watch has a saw blade on it, and he uses the saw blade to cut the ropes, and suddenly he's free, and he frees the girl, and then he's
jumps over to Whisper's side of the room.
Yeah, they swings the crane over, because they're free, and then, like, I think... kicks Whisker, and then he and Kananga get in this very weird knife fight.
Oh, and Kananga does this weird, really strange
cobra thing.
Yeah.
Like both hands over his head holding the knife like this, and then proceeds to bob and weave.
Like,
and
is that supposed to be 1973 Kung Fu?
It's like sexy dance fighting. Yeah. He does like the sexy dance fighting at Bond, and they plunge into the water, and there's sharks around, and then Bond takes the gas pellet and shoves it down Kananga's throat. Can we guess, even if we haven't seen the movie, can we guess what's about to happen? Yes, Kananga inflates like a balloon.
Like unto a Willy Wonka movie, flies up into the air and explodes.
Now this is the most completely ridiculous death of a Bond villain ever. Although for a second, he was Mr. Big.
And again, I don't know whether they decided, well, having him eaten by sharks was just too prosaic, and having Bond shoot him was too mundane, or if it may have just been for Roger to say, well, he always had a very inflated opinion of himself. Which he says.
Because the post-killing one-liner is necessary.
Is necessary.
Oh, Whisper, meanwhile, got, like, kicked into the heroin rocket.
Does he suffocate in there? Does he just...
I don't know. He just doesn't get to participate in the fight anymore.
It would be almost mean-spirited to kill him. He's not the most effective android.
No, he's always tried to kill Bond like two or three times. I figured he was going to be the one that showed up
champagne
like...
champagne and cigars and didn't actually try to kill him or anything.
I thought he was the one that put the snake in.
Oh, he probably put the snake in.
Yeah, and he's also the one that killed the driver. He was the one that killed the driver in New York.
Yeah.
I figured, because I had him pegged for, the guy was going to show up like Rosa Klebb style as their waiter wherever they end up trying, you know, one last stab at killing Mr. Bond.
But it's not. It's not Whisper that shows up.
No. So now
we cut to Bond and Felix in solitaire. They're getting on a train. They're taking a train back north or wherever.
To Washington.
And Felix says to Bond in solitaire, we can do this faster. We're going to get on a train for 16 hours. And Roger cuts Felix the most withering look. And he says, say goodbye to Felix, darling. And then you cut to Bond in solitaire on the train, and he's teaching her gin rummy.
Well, teaching her.
Yeah.
Teaching her gin rummy, which I like is another form of cards.
Yeah, so, right? And he's like, oh, no, well, you don't want to do that unless you need it for gin rummy. And then she goes, gin.
Yeah. And then it's, oh, well, let's have sex. And then as they're all getting ready and whatnot, and Bond's brushing his teeth. Because he's
testing the unlucky at cards, lucky in love thing.
Right. And then who should be on the train cutting his way out of a mailbag but Teehee?
Yeah, did he put himself in a mailbag and have himself mailed onto the train?
I don't know.
How did that work? I mean...
why is he in a bag?
That's the thing. Well, apparently
he got Whisper. He must have gotten Whisper to put him in the bag and tie the bag and put it on the mail cart, right?
Right, because you get the little bit as you see his little mechanical claw hand, which I guess it does have like a... I guess like a serrated edge almost that just actually slices down open.
Yeah, if he completely closes it, it has a blade sticking out on the end. Yes.
And it does make one wonder exactly what's the process here. Did the guys load the bags? Wow, this bag is full of letters, and this bag is full of letters, and this bag feels like it's full of henchmen, but that can't be possible. That can't be that. So, Teehee, and then there's a train fight, which... Right.
He, like, shorts out the fuses to the room with the metal hand, and then...
And Solitaire's just making sweet nothings talk.
She thinks it's Bond in the room. Bond is still in the bathroom.
Oh, James, I feel like a complete woman for the first time in my life.
And, you know, cuts down to... that's Teehee standing there, not James. And Bond comes out of the bathroom and sees that, and, like, he slams the bunk up, so there's Jane Seymour...
trapped in the wall.
James, this isn't funny.
Right. Thud, punch. And then they're having the fight to the death.
And I need to go. I mean, and there's a long tradition of fights to the death on trains in James Bond movies.
I was getting right. Yeah.
From Rush with Love.
They do it again in Spy Who Loved Me.
Yeah.
And they do it in Spectre. There's at least four real good fights to the death on trains. Then they fight and they get Teehee's arm stuck on the window frame, right?
Right, because Bond like cuts the cables because it's an arm. It's not like a mechanical hook. It apparently has some sort of wires and such.
He sees scissors, little scissors in Solitaire's traveling case. Reaches over, grabs a pair, ping, cuts the wire in Teehee's arm.
The coat gets ripped, and so you can see that it actually isn't just like an arm. You know, he mentioned it's an arm, a bit off his arm, but it, you know, you can see like it's just like a metal framework, and there's little cables, I guess, that you know
that
open.
Controlled the pincer, right?
Yeah.
So the pincer locks closed on the window frame.
So he's stuck there, and then Bond flips him out, and then
opens the window and flips him out, and he falls off of the arm.
And the arm is still attached there, and that's
rips off, and then that's the end of Teehee.
And then I think he gets Solitaire out of the bunk, she's not overly amused by this, and
yes, and he says, "What were you doing?" He lets the arm drop, and he's like, "Just being disarming."
Yeah,
and so then we cut to, I think there's an O. James, and there's some Smoochie in there, and then
Baron Samedi on the front of the train.
Yeah, we cut to Baron Samedi going mwahaha on the front of the train, and then they do the smash cut from you know his face to the flaming skull motif you saw from the credits. And we're done.
James Bond will return in Man with the Golden Gun.
And so, I gotta say, certain sociopolitical issues aside, this is really a pretty good movie.
It's not a bad little movie, but oh my god,
is it cringy
in places.
Yeah, it really kind of is.
I mean, there were a couple of heroic black characters. They could have gotten Rosie up there as well, but decided not to. First of all, she was completely incompetent, and also she was...
a traitor.
Yeah.
Yeah, and again, it had been a while since I'd seen this one. I'd forgotten, that she was, you know, double agent. But, you know, you kind of picture, this is the junior field agent who's going to wind up with a severe case of dead.
Uh-huh. The fact that she's going to wind up dead, either earnestly or otherwise, is pretty clear.
Yeah, so that came true. It's just, the double agent bit was maybe a nice little twist, but it would if she'd been a slightly more competent double agent, it would have been. Because, apparently Bond even makes a joke to Quarrel about how she's not a particularly good agent. Mm-hmm. Though, now, how much of that is actually an act that she's not a particularly good agent versus is it... But the thing, it's like...
I guess that may actually have been true that she was the one that helped get rid of the previous guy, too.
I think that's implied. Mm-hmm. But this kind of reached the point where, like I said, the white character goes into Harlem and literally everybody in Harlem is working for the bad guy. Not just select guys, but
Or an entire street scene in New Orleans a couple times.
Although if their alternative is J.W. Pepper, you can't blame them.
or the, you know, the importance of white woman being sacrificed by the voodoo cult is a time-honored tradition from the pulps and such that has its own set of
problematic associations.
The sort of thing we would want to repeat today.
So there's a whole host of stuff in there. Now, is it worse than your average 70s blaxploitation movie?
Probably not.
I don't
normally blaxploit. That's the thing. This is considered to be in the blaxploitation genre, apparently, but despite the name, because they were exploiting the black audiences for money, realizing, oh, we can get these people in here, they usually at least tried to tell some kind of story, even if clumsy and heavy-handed and written by white dudes, about the black underdogs were the ones that were going to put one over on the man or rebel against him somehow, whereas this is literally the man shows up and he's our hero.
Yeah. So is this more of a Britsploitation movie, then?
Britsploitation.
Yeah, you could look at it that way. You could.
It's not a bad movie. Roger Moore is, Roger Moore is great.
He's really great in this.
Your Bond villain, like Mr. Big, is like he's a caricature. He's literally a caricature. That's because he's being played by another guy.
But Kananga is actually, I'm gonna stand by this. Yaphet Kotto's terrific.
Oh, he's great. And so really, you know, you can somewhat forgive Mr. Big being this obvious caricature of an American blaxploitation gangster. When you realize it literally is a character of a blaxploitation gangster. It's like Kananga watched a blaxploitation movie and said, That is my plan.
I'm going to wear a big fur coat.
Now remember...
Platform shoes.
Well, remember Gustav Graves in Die Another Day is literally a caricature of Bond. This guy is literally a caricature of something else.
So from that angle, your principal...
Kananga as a villain is great.
Yeah. Your villain, your Bond girl, those are all very good, very well acted. I mean, Teehee's a great villain. He's a great henchman.
He is. You know, he really is.
He's happy. He likes his, you know, he likes his work.
He's got personality.
Yeah, he's just very, you know, the act, you know, very magnetic actor.
It's mainly just the implication that every black person in like three different places is all working for this guy.
Yeah.
I mean,
is where you get this movie is still racist.
Now the movie's lively. It's got a good pace. It's fun. It's bouncy. Except for the boat chase, doesn't really drag. We've discussed this before. The human scale of it. The scale of it where it's very down to earth and more grounded. We get to the lair at the end and the sharks and
it's
the
like,
thing.
I
but
can
still,
imagine
but most
the production
the
designers like I you know, I can imagine this production design, I don't know if this actually happened. This is in my head, is like production designer going in and saying, I was promised I was working on a James Bond movie. Well, we're trying to do more grounded James Bond. He's like, I am going to build a lair with sharks in it. We can film it, or I can trap you in it. Please choose, Mr. Broccoli.
Please choose, Mr. Broccoli. Yeah, exactly. It is a Bond movie, after all.
You know, so because you work on a Bond movie, you want to do the lair. You kind of want to do that.
There are genre trappings you want and expect in them. Even when you're trying to be more grounded, the forms must be observed. I will say this. I do think the film has, even though it's got very little to do with the book, does have a very Ian Fleming-esque flavor to it. It's the human scale of it. It's kind of bloody and bizarre. I mean, it's genuinely kind of weird and creepy and disturbing that Bond is going to be eaten alive by crocodiles if he can't get out of this.
Oh, that's right, because the book is about pirate gold or something.
The book is
like
literally
that.
About not, pirate yeah. gold, not heroin at all. That they're smuggling pirate gold
like
to fund
Morgan's gold
to fund Soviet activity in the Americas. Fleming novels are very pulpy. As much as he is a journalist and has a journalist's eye for detail and the clothes and the settings and the food and whatnot, he's also got a real serious... These are classically pulpy novels with classically pulpy villains and themes. And this movie feels that way. And it's generally kind of bizarre in some ways. I mean, Guy Hamilton goes from Goldfinger, which is the classic Bond film in a lot of ways, and he does Diamonds Are Forever, and he does Live and Let Die, and he does Man with the Golden Gun, each of which have some genuinely creepy and bizarre elements in them. I think that's kind of what you want a little bit. You want something a little bit bizarre.
And I think Man with the Golden Gun kind of hews back more to your traditional James Bond sort of thing. I mean, it's a little different in that, okay, somebody's the opposite number, the anti-James Bond, has basically been tasked to kill James Bond.
Yeah.
So you've got that. But, you know, I think this one, I don't see them retreading this particular space ever again.
No, although I do remember Sam Mendes saying that this was one of his favorites before he made Skyfall.
There's a lot to like in it.
There is.
And it's got that weird James Bond versus voodoo. It's got that angle that I haven't seen before or since in a James Bond movie.
Yeah. So do we recommend it?
You should watch it.
With the understanding that it was made in 1973 and has the issues that we have discussed.
Yeah. All right. As always, thank you very much for listening. We do, as always, welcome any kind of comments or questions or recommendations or suggestions you have. I am number6@agentsof.cool, all lowercase, all letters.
Ray@agentsof.cool.
And Mrs. Peel, MRSPEEL, all lowercase, no period, @agentsof.cool.
Thank you, as always, for listening. We'll join you again soon, where we will begin our episode-by-episode review of The Prisoner. We'll be right back.
He literally says that.
It's not even really a double entendre. These are single entendres, but Roger gets away with them.
Though that would mean the implication is that the first time James Bond has sex with you, you've only been half cocked. We may have to put an explicit tag on this one.
Yeah.
I perhaps shouldn't have explained that. We may have to put an explicit tag
just,
on this one.
Just cut that one.
One day y'all are going to have to edit this. I can't wait.
Put the explicit tag on there. That's fine.
I am just going to do my best Dennis Leary on that show. Y'all are going to have all kinds of fun.
Edit. I'm not going to edit. I'll just put it up all the way. I'll put the 4-hour version up there. Let people deal with this. So just like you recognize
the pattern of each of us going, oh, we'll learn to recognize the pattern of us saying various curse words.
Fudge.